Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. And with me, to my left, to your right, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, wow, UFC 262. It's a shame that we don't get our originally scheduled five-round co-main event between Nate Diaz and Leon Edwards. That one moved to our next pay-per-view. And that one's going in Phoenix, Arizona. But Matt, really looking forward to Texas's big return to the pay-per-view stage. And listen, we've had huge shows in Texas in the past. I mean, JDS fought Stipe in Dallas. This one here from Houston. And unfortunate for Houston fans, you don't have Derek Lewis. You don't have the heavyweights, but you do have two huge names in your main event. Charles Oliveira taking on Michael Chandler for the vacant lightweight belt. And in your co-main event, the People's Champ, the former interim champ, Tony Ferguson, he's taking on Beneil Dariush. I know we're excited about this one. We're going to have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. We're going to have the fight companion during the pay-per-view main card. Matt, what are you thinking on this one?
I'm really excited for this card. This is one of those, like, all-violence pay-per-view fights where you just love the matchmaking from top to bottom. I saw a tweet out earlier. I don't think anyone's bigger than a minus 230 favorite on this card, and that just tells you how well all these fights have been matched up. We have the return, I guess, if you will, of Tony Ferguson. I know he hasn't been gone for long, but if feels like every time Tony fights, it's this big monumental occasion in the MMA world. And then, of course, in the main event, Michael Chandler, the former Bellator champ. I know the UFC doesn't really like to use that word Bellator. They'll just say champion from another organization. But that champion from another organization finally getting his big chance with Charles Oliveira. I think this main event is a really fun fight for the vacant title. And really, just this whole card, top to bottom, is a really exciting one.
Great fight card. So we'll switch it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, which is, as always, presented by Manscaped. And so many different great fights to choose from. Let's throw it on over there. And when we're talking possible fight of the night, how can you go any further than the curtain jerker on the pay-per-view card? You've got Hurricane Shane Burgos representing New York, New Jersey, the tri-state area. He's taking on Edson Barboza. And Matt, listen, does Edson Barboza have in his Instagram bio that he has a 2012 knockout of the year? Yeah, is he still hanging on to it? I would too. This guy has had an insane highlight reel of a career. And even if he's down and out and down on his luck, maybe he'll just switch up weight classes, go from 155 to 145, try and reinvent things. And listen, in his last five fights, there's three losses peppered in, sandwiched in, really, taking on Shane Burgos, a guy that's 3-2 in his last five. And while it didn't work for him his last time out, the three wins before, big time wins. And even if you go to his fifth to last fight, we're talking about Calvin Kattar. That was quite a while ago, but Shane Burgos always putting on fun fights.
Shane Burgos and Edson Barboza are two fighters that you just get excited about no matter who they're matched up against. And now they're being matched up with each other at 145. Shane Burgos is widely regarded as one of the best pure boxers in MMA. And with Edson Barboza, I would say he's one of the best kickboxers in MMA. So just stylistically, you could not ask for a more fun fight.
Can't wait for this one. And when we flip it on over to our other pick,
wow,
what a fight. I mean, Tony Ferguson, El Cucuy, he's taking on Beneil Dariush. Matt, Beneil Dariush has kind of been one of those guys on the underground for a really long time, and I feel like this week the UFC always puts out these promo teasers on YouTube, fighters that you should know. I bet you Beneil Dariush ends up on one of those little kind of collages, if you will. But you look at the last five, tidy little win streak. You look at the names, and some of them not as big as others. Jakar Close, Scott Holtzman, Hot Sauce, and then his last time out. In the rematch, he gets his second win over Diego Fajeia. And a lot of people might look at that fight and say, well, Diego didn't look good last week against Gregor Gillespie. And he didn't. But in that fight, that was full tank Diego. And wow, Beneil Dariush looked great. For Tony Ferguson, 3-2 in his last five. Killers on the entire record. This guy, again, like an underground champ if you didn't already have Eddie Alvarez. Like the people's champ, but then he ended up winning a belt. Fan favorite in Tony Ferguson, and holy smokes, in those posters does he look like an old man.
Tony Ferguson, no matter what stage of his career at, is still going to be an exciting fighter. Now, are we going to get a diminished version of Tony Ferguson in this fight? You'll have to tune in later for when Craig and I actually break down the fight, but this co-main event could not be more exciting, and I do like this new version of Dariush that we've been getting, this war Dariush, if you will, who just goes out there looking for the knockout, looking for the submission. Both these guys are known for their finishing ability, and again, and this, I guess we're only getting a three-round co-main event now, was the promise 5-round co-main event with Leon Edwards and Nate Diaz. This is one of those fights that could be 5 rounds, and I think a lot of people would be excited about it. But again, this co-main event is going to be absolute fireworks.
Great fight, and can't wait for it. As always, our Fight of the Night screen is presented by Manscaped. Make sure you check them out. Manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. They just dropped the Lawnmower 4.0. I'll talk about that and my nuts later on in the show, but I can't wait for these two picks and the rest of this entire card. Really interesting fight on UFC 262. We have the return of Sean Soriano taking on the Spartan Christos Yagos. Matt, in this fight, this rarely ever happens where you have two fighters that have each had two stints in the UFC. For Sean Soriano, it was way back. It was the UFC's first card in Singapore, and he took on a fellow debuting fighter to the UFC in a co-main event slot. That's absolutely insane. The main event of that card, former Strikeforce champ Tarek Saffedine taking on Hyun-Gyu Lim. And Matt, for Sean Soriano, it was Kawajiri. And at the time, Kawajiri was what, 35? Like, Sean Soriano was the young guy coming out of the Black Zillions. He was kind of a jack of all trades. He had a high school state champion wrestling background. He had really good striking that was coming along. Henry Hooft in his corner. And I remember the conversation going into it. It was like, Sean Soriano and Henry Hooft's an up and comer. These guys, they're going to make a huge dent in the UFC. Soriano, he's able to stuff the first few takedowns, and then it's pretty well all Kawajiri. But Matt, Kawajiri's an absolute legend in Japan, and that was a fight where I could understand a guy losing a fight like that. You're a really young guy. You're getting a push super early in your career against somebody like that on incredibly short notice. Probably not going to win the fight. But then he lost to Chaz Skelly, and you really start to get the doubts. He ends up losing one more, and you look at them, it's tricky. I mean, decent level of competition that way. He goes outside of the UFC, wins his first fight, then loses two in a row. Now, since then, he's able to kind of string things together. Still a guy at Sanford MMA, still training with the Michael Chandlers of the world and so on. And he's just an interesting test case of a guy that's really good at everything. I feel like from all the tape I've seen, his striking's got better.
Oh, yeah.
He actually knocked out Noad Lahat in his last fight, Bellator UFC vet. And it's just a great thing to watch. His really, really big performance. And again, the level of competition, I don't know. I mean, if you look at Saul Almeida's overall record on Tapology, it's a lot of wins and then a lot of losses. And he went over to boxing and it just didn't go well. But Soriano's able to just piece him up. He can really strike on the back foot, knocks him out with a crazy right hand. And it was great. Taking on Christos Yagos, Matt, I know we're both going to touch on this. Yagos is one of the fastest starters that you're going to find in this division, and boy, can he wrestle early.
He really can, but Christos Yagos is the one fighter on this UFC roster who should probably invest in a Peloton bike, because I've never seen a more tired man by the time that, like, third minute rolls around in that third round. And honestly, I might be giving him too much credit saying that he can hold on that long into the third round, because I've never seen a fighter who in the first 5 minutes of a fight, I'm like, wow, I like a lot of what he's doing. And in the last 5 minutes of a fight, I'm like, wow, I dislike everything he's doing. And that kind of is the story of Christos Yagos, because really against anybody, what can he do? He's a good striker on the outside. He's got great volume on the outside. I don't think he has great power, but he's got good power on the feet. Is he good on the mat? Well, yeah, he's a great Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt with decent wrestling as well. But my issue is that Christos Yagos has one of those weird, and I'm going to call it a Goldilocks issue. He just doesn't know if he should be burning too hot or too cold. It's odd, because I always forget Paulo Costa when I think about fighters like this, because Costa's just one of those fighters who, in the first 2 rounds of a fight, he can throw 400 punches. And just from that stat, you know, okay, if he can taper himself off to any degree, then he probably has decent cardio, because it's really hard to have that kind of output. With Yagos, though, I don't know what coach he could ever go to or what gym he could ever train with to try to fix this hole in his game, because it is really odd. Do I like the ground control of Yagos? Yeah, I like it a lot, actually, especially if he gets in top position. Do I like the transition of Yagos? Yeah, quite a bit. I love the volume, and I really like the forward pressure. It's just odd, because you rarely see fighters who that is the biggest speaking point of his career. I do like a lot of what Christos Yagos does, but the fact that he falls off such a cliff in that third round just makes me hesitant every single time I have to predict one of his fights.
So his last fight was on really short notice when he took on Carlton Minus, and it was kind of a short notice one for Minus too. So you go into that one, you watch the regional tape on Minus, and listen, the tape's out and he's no longer in the UFC, but what was he good at? He kind of boxed a little bit. He was decent from the outside. He could throw pretty good volume. And Christos Yagos looked amazing. So if we really focus on from his Charles Oliveira loss that was in late 2018 since, he beat Mizuto Hirota, Demir Hadzevich, lost to Dracara Close, beat Carlton Minus. I got to go through these stats, Matt, because in the Hirota fight, he had a possible 10-8 in the first round. He lost the third round. Then he takes on, like I said, Hadzovic. Two of three of those judges gave the third round to Hadzovic. Then you go to the fight that he takes on Jakar Close. Listen, Yagos, on all of their accounts, won the first round. The other three went to Jakar Close, a guy that can keep that work rate. He's really, really good with his cardio. And then in the Carlton Minus fight, there were two 10-8s in round one. And then two of the three judges gave the third round to Minus, a guy that was totally like a fish out of water in the first and second rounds. So again, for Christos Yagos, I absolutely love his game. But that third round comes so fast. And it's like, it's again, like a fighter that we just talked about a few weeks ago. Luke friggin' Sanders. The guy has a good first round. And then in the second, it's bad. And then in the third, it's really bad. But at least, like, with Luke Sanders, Yagos, it's not like, oh, it happens once. It's just about every fight.
Christos Yagos is the UFC's Ben Simmons. I think that's what we've agreed upon. He's good at a lot of things, but it's like, wait, you can't shoot? Wait, not just threes, like, at all? It's like, okay, if you have that big of a glaring issue in your game, it is just going to be a concern, especially... I would say Jakar Close, other than Charles Oliveira, of course, is the highest level of competition that Yagos has been in there with. And he still had that same issue against Close, but you can tell when he does fight those better fighters up the rankings a little bit, that's when that hole in cardio really does start to become an issue because he can go out there. And I think his opponents know if we can kind of give up that first round against this guy because we know he's going to burn so hot, he's going to have nothing left in the second and the third. The interesting thing about Sean Soriano is it's not all that often that you have a guy in his UFC run, or at least his first UFC run, he kind of fought three versions of the same fight. Now, yes, Soriano, Skelly, and Rosa, they're all different in their own respects, but they can all really employ that heavy grappling style if they choose to. And for Yagos, he can have that type of a fight if he wants to, but again, and we're going to feed this fed horse, Yagos, my only question in this fight, we've talked a lot, my only question is, can Yagos not get tired or at least dominate enough of this fight until he does get tired? Because I'm pretty comfortable in saying that Christos Yagos is going to win the first round. I think he can probably win the second round, but that's my real issue. Can he win the second round? That's going to be the flip round in this fight. Personally, I do think Yagos can get enough with his overall volume because the weird thing about Christos Yagos is he just does enough to not get finished in that third round. And I do feel like he's a smart enough fighter, and I use that word with a little bit of hesitancy because he's a smart enough fighter to where if he knows that he has two rounds in the bank, he can just do enough to not get finished. And you hate that that's a fighter's style where it's like, wow, if there was open rounds, then maybe Christos Yagos would be undefeated. But I do think Yagos is a smart enough fighter that if he does go out there and win those first two rounds, he can do enough to at least keep the third competitive or at least keep the third from being a 10-8 to the point where Yagos can win a decision.
I would say that Yagos' toughest test was probably his first UFC debut. It was the one against Gilbert Burns. And then again, you look at Soriano, you talked about it. I mean, Kawajiri being the first fight, then you have Skelly, then you have Charles Rosa. Those are tough fights for anybody, except for Bryce Mitchell, and we could go down through the line. But they really are tough fights, especially back when Soriano made his debut. Again, he kind of took his lumps on the regional scene again, and then he's risen back up. The line just opened because, again, this fight was just announced. Christos Yagos, but a minus 225 favorite. Sean Soriano, a plus 175. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, again, not going to be a lot of them. 787, 82% Yagos, 84% by decision. And when you look at this one, it was actually originally supposed to be Spain's Joel Alvarez. It was supposed to be taking on Yagos. Hot take, I probably would have taken Alvarez in that fight because, again, you look at it, Yago's going to take him down. Alvarez, really long, lanky guy that gets really unorthodox submissions. It would have been a good one that way, but for Soriano, very, very well-rounded fighter. So what are you thinking here?
So last thing for Yagos, people do forget his last time out was on short notice for him. And yes, his cardio is never good, but I do feel like that was slightly accentuated in that bout because it was on short notice for Yagos. I do think he'll be able to get a, I'm going to assume, decision win. I don't even know why I threw it out there. It's not like we always do predictions spot on or anything. But I do think he'll be able to do enough, like I said, in those first two rounds to at least separate himself enough from Soriano to where the third round will be less of a factor. So my official prediction will be Christos Yagos.
If Soriano can defend those takedowns in the first round, it's going to get easier and easier and easier. Now, again, I see this fight, and we talked about it last week. Tafon Chukwe, Jin Young Park. It's one of those ones where, what's Tafon going to do? Are we going to go out there and volume strike? Are we going to try and even take him down? And for Jin Young Park, method of victory, probably going to be the takedown. He waited until the end of that fight, but he was able to stay behind the jab. He was able to pump the volume. I've seen that from Sean Soriano, where he can pump the volume. He can land some of those power shots. He can get takedowns of his own. If he can defend the early takedowns, like I think he's probably been able to work on all these years, I think there's a decent opportunity for a guy at a plus 175 and Sean Soriano to get the win. So I'm going to go against the odds. I'm going to go against the fans. We're going to disagree on this one early on in the week. I can't wait to see these guys face off, though, and we can offer up our final pick on question mark kicks. But Matt, I'm going with the return. I'm going Sean Soriano. You've got the Spartan here, right?
I do.
Matt's got the Spartan. Really looking forward to this fight. And boy, do we ever have a great card. Beneil Dariush, Tony Ferguson, Michael Chandler, Charles Oliveira. Can't wait for UFC 262. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Neat fight we have coming up this weekend at lightweight. We have the UFC debut of Top Gun Tucker Lutz. And he's going to be taking on, I'm assuming, the guy like Slayer, Angelo Jack! Kevin Aguilar, Matt, for Jackson Winks, Kevin Aguilar, former LFA champ at 145 pounds. He came in on the Contender Series. He came into the UFC, and he looked pretty good before losing his last three fights. And the thing for Kevin Aguilar is you look at the names. Dan Ige, well, that's probably going to happen. Zubair Tukugov, well, that might happen. So then he moves up from 45 to 55, loses split decision to Charles Rosa, and now we're here. So we got a guy that used to be a featherweight fighting at lightweight. Height-wise, reach-wise, both guys about the same. Now we got to focus in on Tucker Lutz. And really, when we do, Matt, it's an interesting one because this is a guy that doesn't train at the biggest gym. He's a guy out of Maryland. It's Owings Mills, Maryland is where he's from, fighting out of Ground Control. And I went back, I watched some of the tape. If he really wants to win, he's got to mix it up. Maybe strike a little bit early, but into the clinch, get your takedowns, ride it out on top. And there's a great method of victory for Tucker Lutz, a guy who, in the pre-show for Contender Series, just wanted to work with his hands. Dad owned a sod business, you know, loading sod onto pallets, taking him out to job sites. Just the way to be, really, Matt. But I look at the way that Tucker Lutz fights. It's kind of interesting. He kind of stands a little bit square in front of you. He throws a lot of power into his shots. And really, he did it on the regional scene. He did it a bit on Contender Series. Will he do it in the UFC where there'll be some jitters? I don't know. But it's an interesting stylistic matchup for Lutz to be taking on Aguilar. And for Aguilar, he's taking on some really good competition. When you look at Lutz and his way up to the UFC, he lost his debut. He's on an 11-fight win streak. But the combined opponent's record all throughout his pro career, 59 and 52. It's a little salty.
Yeah, you don't love to see that. Now, I have to be completely honest. I don't think I've been more wrong about a fighter in Kevin Aguilar since I have about Jonathan Martinez. Like, those are the two fighters I might have the worst reads on. Because after Aguilar beat Enrique Barrazola, and just for complete transparency, you know, we talk about Randy Marcos a lot, how it's like, hey, we really like it when this fighter beat Randy Marcos on her way up. Enrique Barzola is just one of those names, you know? It's like, yeah, he might never become champ. He might never even have a ranking next to his name. But if you beat Enrique Barzola, it means, well, you must have decent takedown defense. You must have all right striking because he throws a lot of volume. And he must have pretty good cardio, too. I had really high hopes for Aguilar, especially coming out of that fight, because he was just kind of able to out Enrique Barzola. Barzola did well. But then you look after that fight, he loses to Danny Gay. No shame, because Danny Gay's fighting the Korean Zombie in what could be one of the greatest fights of the year. My issue with Kevin Aguilar is, if he just had a little bit more power, I actually think he'd be not a dominant force in this division, because especially him fighting up at lightweight, but I think he'd be a really hard fighter to deal with, because with Aguilar, I actually like his cardio, I like his forward pressure, I like a few things about Aguilar. My issue is that he just doesn't have enough pop in his hands to really get the respect of his opponents. Even look back at that Danny Gay fight. Him and Danny Gay were landing kind of shot for shot, at least in the beginning of that fight, but you could tell that as Danny Gay was starting to land with more volume, it was taking a toll on Kevin Aguilar that the shots of Aguilar just weren't able to do on Dan Ige. Even look back at the Charles Rosa fight, and listen, I might be one of the bigger critics on Charles Rosa, if you will, but I thought Charles Rosa won that fight. Like, he looked pretty good, and the problem with Aguilar, I thought Aguilar would at least be competitive in some of those grappling exchanges with Rosa, but Rosa really had his way with him on the mat, and that's what was so disappointing. I can talk about the things that I wish Kevin Aguilar had, but I thought he was a decent wrestler, and I thought he was good on the mat, but after that Charles Rosa fight, I just don't really know what I'm getting with Kevin Aguilar at this point.
Well, the weird thing about Aguilar, and listen, we take the metrics into account every now and again. You look at the UFC stats, if you have a good body of work, and you can really kind of take out a few oddities along the way. Priscilla Cachoeira as a fighter on this card, where you can go, okay, the Valentina Shevchenko fight was a wild beatdown, but apart from that, she's fought the level of competition she should. For Kevin Aguilar, it's been a decent level of competition. Even Dan Ige, at the time, it made sense at 45 to make that fight. So then I look at Kevin Aguilar and fight metric. 91% of the time he's striking. 9% of the time he's going for takedowns.
He hasn't really done anything in terms of submissions in the UFC, so it's just odd. It's not the guy that you think of, really. Then you look at his overall numbers. Okay, so you're a striker. 3.69 strikes given per minute to 4.47 taken. So he's getting outstruck, but he's striking 91% of the time. What are we doing here? Then you look at the takedowns. 37% accuracy to 53% defense. Well, that's not good. Like, it's just really hard to get a read on Aguilar.
There's a version out there of Kevin Aguilar that I'm sure I really like. But the fact that, again, he doesn't do the things that we assume he would be going for more. If he was a much more takedown-heavy fighter, if he had a little bit more pop in his shots, like, if he just did any one area a little bit better, then I think we would be dealing with a fighter, maybe not a top 15 guy, but just one of those guys. I'll throw a name like Randy Brown out there. Like, not everyone can have a ranking next to their name, so they just have to be a monster outside the rankings. And I do think Kevin Aguilar could have some of those interesting competitive wins afterwards. It will be interesting to see how he fights at 155, just because, again, up a weight class, it should be interesting. I don't think he'll have any cardio issues. I doubt the weight cut should be an issue for him, but it is always interesting to see, especially when a guy moves up in weight and it's only 10 pounds. Normally we see it from like middleweight to light heavyweight. That can make a massive issue, but still, from featherweight to lightweight, like Max Holloway did it, and he showed that, yeah, you kind of have to adjust your body to the weight class. So it will be really interesting for Kevin Aguilar moving forward in this fight. But for Tucker Lutz, like, this is a really great fight to have for your UFC debut. Your friend Kevin Aguilar, who, yes, he is on a losing streak, but hear me out. He's lost, like we said. We made sure that we mentioned the names that Aguilar's lost to. If you're able to beat a guy like Kevin Aguilar, then you're all of a sudden lumped in with those names, like a Charles Rosa, who, yeah, Charles Rosa's not, like, the biggest deal in the world. But if John Anik really likes you, then you're doing something right.
That's a Boston connection.
I know that's a Boston connection, but still, it would do great things for Lutz's career, especially with your UFC debut being against a guy like Aguilar, who, yes, he might not have this big shine next to his name. He might be on a 3-fight losing streak, but again, beating a guy like Aguilar is going to prove us a lot, at least going forward in Tucker's career.
So if we look at, Matt's just going to have to refer to him from Tucker from now on. It's Tucker Lutz. But if we look at Tucker Lutz and his overall body of work, again, you come into the UFC. So let's go 2018 up. 2018, 3 fights, 3 wins, all finishes. 12-5 was the record of Francisco Isada. And then if you go and look at it, it's the saltiest 12-5. Then he beats Timothy Wade, who was 3-14. Then he beats Wesley Golden, 8-11. But again, we talk about it. They're finishes. They're quick finishes. You like to see it. Then he fights Cole Presley, 6-3. Then he beats Trevor Thompson, 2-2. And then he fights Chase Gibson. Gibson was coming up from 45 to 55 to take the fight. Gibson looked great in the first round. He was doing a good job of striking. And you could hear the commentary team say, hey, from what we've seen in Tucker Lutz and from what I've seen in him from his fights on the amateur or the regional circuit, he gets hit. He can, if he gets kicked, he brings his hands down. If he gets punched, he brings his hands up, and then they kind of stay up. They don't really stay anywhere in between. His striking defense can be a little bit shifty, but he's finishing guys, not Chase Gibson. And in that fight, he was a huge favorite. He was a minus 470 favorite. He won it by decision. They didn't give him a contract in that episode. He had to come back and fight again. He fought Sherrard Blackage. He gets a win over there. He was a plus 155 underdog. He wins by decision. It's like, oh, okay. Well, here's your contract. You fought twice. That was the season finale of the show. But I just, again, I haven't seen it from Lutz. Lutz has to prove it to me, and this is the prove me fight.
No, that's a really good point. I kind of have to take Aguilar until I see something different from Tucker in this fight. If he is able to go out there, let's say he gets a first round finish, then great. From here on out, I'll have a much better idea. But I still do think that I'm going to have to stick with Aguilar in this fight. It's not that I love anything from him. It's just I have much more of a base of knowledge to go off of. And again, if he can string together, I don't love his volume, but he can get some decent volume together on the feet. And if he is able to somewhat overwhelm Lutz with that, then he might have some success. But this is one of those really do or die fights for Aguilar.
I mean, you look at the odds, they kind of flip-flop. Both guys open at par, minus 110 for Aguilar. He's now minus 102 underdog. And if you look at Lutz, minus 122. Over on Tapology, everybody's got Lutz. 940 total votes, 73% with Lutz, 76% by decision. For the 27% that have Aguilar, 76% by decision as well. To me, it's the all must have forgot fight. We'll see what happens. We could be totally wrong, Matt. I really want to know what people are thinking down in the comment section on this one.
I don't think this will be a finish. That, again, I do kind of side with the Tapology voters in that, but yeah, I do like Aguilar. Again, if you're on a 3-fight losing streak, you kind of are fighting for your job in that 4th fight, so I think he realizes, like, if I lose this one, this is it. So yeah, ever so slightly picking Aguilar.
Thanks. The earlier Contender Series fighter beating the guy that needed 2 fights on the Contender Series, we're both going with Kevin Aguilar, the former LFA champ, get the win. Matt, big fights at lightweight on this entire card, but our main event, holy smokes, for the vacant belt, you have Charles Oliveira taking on Michael Chandler. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Danger! There's a zombie girl running around. Matt, we have Gina Mazzani representing Alaska, taking on Brazil's Priscilla Cachoeira. Matt, when I think about this fight, it kind of boils down to two different styles, and you're going to hear that all of fight week. For Priscilla Cachoeira, the real sales pitch on her to get a fight whatsoever with Valentina Shevchenko, who was coming down from 135, who had fought Amanda Nunes twice, was, well, this is a knockout artist at flyweight. We're really going to kick this division right off on the right foot. And then Valentina Shevchenko outstruck her 96-2, if we're just going off significant strikes. And it was disgusting in a bloodbath, and you haven't seen Mario Yamasaki ref in the UFC since. But after that, there were a couple more losses. Molly McCann, she got out-grappled in that one. She got outstruck. Then she fought Luana Carolina in a fight that was back and forth, and it was an interesting fight, but she ended up losing that one. And then she had a performance of the night bonus when she knocked out Shanna Dobson and absolutely planted and threw, and holy smokes, it was a good flurry of action for Priscilla Cachoeira. It was what we were waiting for. It was the bill of goods that we were sold when she was coming into the UFC fighting, and I can't stress this enough, Valentina Shevchenko. How crazy is that? Now, Matt, I'm going to let you take over. How crazy is it that Gina Mazzani's UFC debut was against a former title challenger in Sarah McMahon? And also, how crazy was it that we were there?
If Drake made a song about both these fighters' careers, it would have been started from the top, then we fell quite a bit from there. Because it kind of was the case. Sarah McMahon, all the way at the top of the division, Gina Mazzani's best win up until that point was over a fighter who was 2-1 in her professional career. Could you imagine beating someone who was 2-1 and then the UFC calling her up being like, hey, you want to fight an Olympic gold medalist? Because my answer would be no. I'm going to be very honest about that. My answer would absolutely be no. Now, the craziest thing about that fight and the craziest stat I can give you about that fight was that Gina Mazzani actually missed weight at bantamweight. So it was always really weird to me, or it was really weird to me. When I first heard that Mazzani was going to move down to flyweight, I just thought, A, it's kind of a weird match. She was big for bantamweight, or at least seemed so physically, because Gina Mazzani, one of those fighters who, I always think about John Jones when I think about this, got big into powerlifting. She, I think it was the national kettlebell champion. I don't know if she was the champion or she had just competed at the event.
Was on it involved at all?
Pardon?
Was on it involved at all?
They might have been. I don't remember. But I do know Gina Mazzani big into competitive kettlebell lifting. So there's a fun little fact. But this really will be an interesting fight and the definition of a clash of styles. Because with Mazzani, we've seen it. When she strikes in the UFC, it never ends well for her. And I mean never at all. Look back at the Macy Chaisson fight. And yes, Macy is a ridiculous Muay Thai striker. Don't get me wrong. But Gina went out there like throwing two jabs like she was Canelo and just got lit up at distance. My problem with Gina Mazzani's striking is that she just reacts a lot to what her opponent's doing on the feet. And you can tell that she is a much more natural grappler. And you don't need me to tell you. And I understand her level of competition hasn't been the best throughout the UFC. But just look at her Rachel Ostovich fight. On the feet, she's a little bit awkward, don't get me wrong. But the second she gets that fight to the mat, she is absolutely dominant in her positional control. And not just to the point where she's staying on top like she's Jake Shields. She's getting good damaging shots off with her ground and pound. So there's something there with Gina Mazzani that you can improve, and that there's definitely a skill set that could eventually make its way into the top 20 or into the top 15 at 125. Because with Mazzani, I felt like we were seeing an extremely green fighter, her first fight in the UFC, but she has definitely built upon that first fighter who we saw against Sarah McMahon all those years ago.
And she kind of had to leave the UFC briefly to get a little bit better, but I think really the camp change probably did her quite a bit of good. I mean, going from Extreme Couture to Glory MMA and Fitness, she has the Tim Elliott connection. But one of the things that we talked about in Tim Elliott's preview before he fought Jordan Espinosa, it was like, okay, well, we have these good wrestlers and good, well-rounded fighters. And I went back and I watched the Tim Elliott interview beforehand. And he said, my wife's been working out and training a lot with James Gallagher. And at first I went, what, like SBG's James Gallagher? Yeah, but they both gained a couple of different things. Then Tim Elliott goes out there, beats the crap out of Jordan Espinosa, airs his dirty laundry, gets him cut from the UFC. Gina Mazzani fights Rachel Ostovich and, well, didn't really reveal, like, OnlyFans passwords. I don't know OnlyFans all that well. But Gina Mazzani looked great in that
fight.
She did. Physically looked really good at 125. Again, weighed 125.5. For Priscilla Cachoeira, again, really good striker. More of a boxer than she is a complete striker.
Just Are you a really good striker if you only knock out Shayna Dawson and you get outstruck in all your other UFC fights?
Yeah, she beat Rosie Duarte on the regional scene. But again, like, you look at it, you know exactly what Cachoeira does. She comes out of Academia Team Figueiredo.
High guard.
With the Figueiredo brothers, I had to write it down. One of her coaches, it was Jose Carlos Guimarães. And she also had, and I find this one of the more interesting people to see on the Instagrams getting ready for a fight, Michelle Prezeris getting ready with Trator. So if you look at, Traktor, if you look at him, what is he? Well, a guy that couldn't make 155 to save his life, but a short, thick man that can wrestle till the end of days. Maybe not like Gina Masani, but it's somebody that's halfway decent to see there that at least they're training or they're just posing for the gram.
That's one of those, like, yeah, I played one-on-one against Kevin Durant. He beat me by 21. I didn't score. I just don't know if he can learn that much from Prezeris because he is so much bigger. And that's really my issue in this fight. It's weird because when I think of Cachoeira, she could probably make 115, whereas Gina Mazzani, I would almost feel like, belongs more 135. Or at least that's what I assume going into this fight. Because here's the thing, and I'll openly admit this. In my mind, Gina Mazzani's so much bigger than Priscilla Cachoeira. It's not even funny. I look at this matchup like it's Godzilla versus King Kong until you actually see Godzilla versus King Kong, and then they had this whole backstory for why King Kong was the same size. There's not the biggest size discrepancy between these two, like I'd originally assumed going into this matchup.
So the last two things I have, and these are neat, these are party stats. If you look at it for Priscilla Cachoeira, she was supposed to fight Courtney Casey on Halloween. That was the Anderson Silva fight against Uriah Hall. Spooky. Botched weight cut was the reason why she pulled out of that fight with cast iron Courtney Casey. Also, Matt, this fight is to determine the Queen of August. The Queen of August, 1988. These women were both born on the same day in the same year. It's crazy. Matt, if we look at the odds for this one, Mazzani opened a minus 300 favorite. She's minus 209 at this point. Priscilla Cachoeira, plus 230. She's now a plus 169. The odds corrected themselves right off the bat. If you look over on Tapology, 981 total votes. 69% going with Mazzani, 88% by decision. For Cachoeira, 32% have her to win by knockout. But I don't know. It's a really tough ask. Again, you look at the Shayna Dawson fight. Dobson can wrestle, but she just kind of also planted and threw. And Cachoeira hit her with a crazy right hand and knocked her out. Like, knocked her out.
Yeah, Shayna Dawson. I've done my Shayna Dawson piece. I'll just let it be for now. Cachoeira has a puncher's chance, and she has shown the ability to defend at least basic takedowns in the Molly McCann fight. But my issue is that Gina Mazzani is a wrestler. And I think of Molly McCann, her primary skill set is her boxing. Now, yes, she's a decent grappler. She can go out there and get takedowns, but that's what Gina Mazzani does. And the fact that Priscilla's basically been able to get taken down every time she's gotten in there with a semi-competent grappler, I just see this fight being more of the same. I think Priscilla can go and land a big shot. Don't get me wrong, but I think it takes more than one big shot, especially at 125, to hurt Mazzani. So I'm going to have to pick Gina Mazzani at the end of the day.
Both of us going with Glory MMA and Fitness's Queen of August 1988, Gina Mazzani, to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. Big time main event. Michael Chandler, your three-time Bellator lightweight champ, taking on Charles De Bronx Oliveira. Can't wait for it, Matt. Great fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at flyweight. We have a couple of different fighters really trending in different directions. Andrea Lee, who's lost her last three, and Antonina Shevchenko, who's 3-2 in her last five. The loss is kind of staggered in between. And it's been an interesting level of competition for both of these women, Matt. For Andrea Lee, the last three losses, Joanne Calderwood by split decision, Lauren Murphy by split decision, and Roxanne Modafferi by unanimous decision. The scariest thing, if you're a big Andrea Lee supporter, is the support of everybody else for Andrea Lee, especially the gamblers, because these are the odds out of those last three fights. Minus 250 against Calderwood, minus 300 against Murphy, minus 320 against Roxanne Modafferi. Are you surprised by that?
Okay, not really, only because I had this point made way in advance. Andrea Lee was the first wolf ticket contender at 125 pounds that people thought maybe if she can get on a run could beat Valentina. Because here's the thing, people forget, Andrea Lee was like Caitlin Chookagian with a little bit more pop on her shots. She was the original, I'm going to backpedal an awful lot and you're going to walk into my shots for a while. But there was, now I'm going to call them a vocal minority, but there definitely was a group of people who thought, hey, if Andrea Lee can make her way to a title shot, she might be able to frustrate the champion and win. Now, I think that was insane at the time. I think we can all look at that in hindsight and say, of course, Valentina would have absolutely dominated Andrea Lee. But there was a time when there's some real hype behind Andrea Lee. And that's why it's kind of wild to see her on this three-fight losing streak. Because, okay, you lose split decision to Joanne Calderwood, who is a very talented fighter on the feet. The majority of that fight was contested on the feet. No big deal. You lose split decision to Lauren Murphy. That was, again, a very close fight. Now, I have to be completely honest. I did think Calderwood and Murphy both beat her. But again, if you have two close fights against two other top five, top 10 talents in the division, it's still proves that you belong. And then she fights Roxanne Modafferi, the ultimate litmus test, some might say, because Roxanne's just like, hey, are you either on your way down or on your way up? Roxanne Modafferi is going to help you find out. But Roxanne was just able to really stifle the attack of Andrea Lee. And this is the weird thing. Andrea Lee, I could always just kind of know how she was going to fight. Like I had said, she was the original Caitlin Chookagian. Yes, she backpedaled a lot. She went a lot and didn't hit all the time, but still, she was able to just land such an accumulation of volume on her opponents that at the end, you just kind of knew what the judges were going to say. They were going to be like 30-27 Andrea Lee. She was just going to overwhelm her opponents with volume. But we've seen, at least throughout her last three fights, fighters give her zero respect on the feet nowadays. Isn't it interesting? I've never seen a fighter whose career has just switched so drastically. It's kind of like she was at the three-point line, and then people just decided, hey, we'll stand in the paint, and we'll just let them shoot three-pointers. Because for Andrea Lee, once fighters realize I can walk through her power, they've been able to land on her. And when you see fighters like Joanne Calderwood do it, when you see fighters like even Roxanne Modafferi do it, it leaves me reason to believe that Antonina Shevchenko can really just replicate a similar game plan to her last three opponents.
The weird thing is, though, for Shevchenko, and you look at it, the five on in. Jeon Kim, that's a win. You lose by split to Roxanne Modafferi, the name you brought up. She submits Lucia Pudzilova. She loses to Caitlin Chookagian in a fight where, and this is the weird thing, we've seen Antonina even in the Lipski fight. I'm a wrestler now. Well, in the fight against Chookagian, Chookagian went, I'm a wrestler now. And Shevchenko had zero answer for it because I bet she thought, hey, she's going to stick and move, like every other Caitlin Chookagian fight. And Chookagian did full wear the hood hat, and she went out there and put her wrestling shoes on. Shevchenko gained a lot in her last fight, but again, how good's Ariane Lipski? The queen of violence? I don't know. Sometimes you're doing the grossest knee bar to Luana Carolina, and sometimes you're losing fights to people that a lot of people haven't heard of. So it's really tough to get a read on her. For Antonina Shevchenko, you know the striking pedigree's there. You know Pavel's going to be in the corner. You know that they're training at a hole-in-the-wall gym, so let's give shouts where they are. At Bushi Ban over in Texas, outside of Houston. And if you look at it for Andrea Lee, this is the thing that I don't know if it's going to make the biggest difference, because she's somebody that's trained in and around the Louisiana, Texas type of areas. She's been training out of Colorado for a bit now, and I got to name out some of the training partners. She's at Pound for Pound Fitness, which is very closely related to Elevation, so you get the same striking coach in Justin Houghton. But also, Montana De La Rosa, former opponent of Andrea Lee. Tisha Torres is there. Claire Guthrie. A lot of the same people that you saw in the pictures for Lupi Godinez when she spent just a little bit of time there going, again, Vancouver, Colorado, down to the fight in Florida. For Lupi, you can't blame training on the fight that she had against Jessica Penne. You can blame the judges. But if you look at it, Aspen Ladd, another person there as well to train with. I like to see that out of Andrea Lee, but for Shevchenko, it's been the same old for years, and it works for both these gals.
It is weird. Okay, you had kind of mentioned it. Shevchenko, they're going to bill her as a Muay Thai fighter. They're going to tell you all these great things she did in Muay Thai. She's going to go out there and shoot double legs. It is really weird, because for Antonina, they talk about her like she grew up like she was Bruce Lee, like she grew up in the mountains, and she has this one-inch death punch, but it is weird. We've seen Shevchenko A, get outclassed in the feet too many times to continue to call her like an MMA Muay Thai striker, because that is the thing. I honestly think Andrea Lee is probably going to be able to outstrike Antonina Shevchenko on the feet, but if Antonina Shevchenko can get a takedown, I think she can have good success in top position, which is weird because you would just assume going into this fight, well, okay, Andrea Lee could be backpedaling and it's going to just come down to can Shevchenko march her down. I really do think this fight comes down more to the takedowns than Shevchenko's ability to cut off the cage, although I do believe both are going to be really important, because for Andrea Lee, whether it's a win or a loss, you know how she's going to fight. She is still going to backpedal. She's going to try to land those straight shots. It normally just comes down to the opponent's A, ability to either secure a takedown like Roxanne Modafferi was able to do, or B, close off the cage like Joanne Calderwood was able to do, because that was the one thing Calderwood did really well in that fight. She was able to get Andrea Lee in the clinch and land a lot of elbows up close, because for Lee, she is really good at fighting at distance, but she's another one of those fighters who, if you get on the inside of her distance, she doesn't have great elbows, doesn't have great knees, so you can kind of stifle some of her offense. I think if Shevchenko does try to get this into the clinch, go for some of those body trips and whatnot, I think Shevchenko should be able to have another big win.
So if you look at the odds for this one, they're relatively close. Lee opened a plus 120. She's now at a plus 110. For Shevchenko, open around a minus 150. She's a minus 134. If we look at the Tapology votes at the same time as you do, wow. 1,040 total votes, 82% Shevchenko, 81% by decision. For the 18% that have Lee, 87% by decision. So you go from being 2.5 to 3 to 1 favorite in your last three fights, losing them. Now you're a decent-sized underdog, and the fan vote has totally swayed over to Shevchenko. Like, this is crazy.
You know what you're getting with Andrea Lee, and that's the problem. Again, once opponents figured out that, hey, she might be a striker, but there's no threat with her strikes. Like, you can walk through everything Andrea Lee throws at you. Look at Joanne Calderwood. Like, she was able to do that. Look at the Montana De La Rosa fight as well. De La Rosa was getting dominated at distance, but she was able to get in close on a few occasions against Lee. Now, yes, as that fight progressed, there's the one thing about Andrea Lee that I haven't given her credit for. Great cardio. Phenomenal cardio. Anyone who can move backwards like that while still striking is going to have really good cardio. But again, at the end of the day, I just think it comes down to who's not only the more aggressive fighter, but who's the fighter who lands the majority of their shots at the end of the day. Shevchenko, I do think, will be landing a lot more than she's missing, and I do think if either fighter's able to secure a takedown, it's going to be Shevchenko in this matchup.
I have a really hard time with this fight, again, because it's, are we not giving enough credit to Lee? Are we giving too much to Shevchenko? We've seen Shevchenko lose to Chookagian. We've also seen Lee lose to top fighters. Murphy was our 2020 fighter of the year. You got to look at Calderwood. I mean, she was right in that title contention. And then tricky old Roxanne Modafferi, who gave both of these women fits. So it is really tough. I will slightly side again with Shevchenko because I've seen those added wrinkles to her game. But it is a tricky one for me.
Andrea Lee is like Tyler Hansborough. You're like, wow, you were really good before you got to the big leagues. And that really was the case because Andrea Lee was so hyped up on her way into the UFC. I don't really think people understand. Like, you're even given the face. Andrea Lee really was like not the prospect, but one of the contenders at this division when it was first created. Now, yes, the fact that she's on a 3-fight losing streak is going to cloud that. But people do have to understand, like, Andrea Lee was that girl at this division for a long time. I just don't think she has the answer for Shevchenko in this one.
Matt, not a big Bobcats fan, not an Adam Morrison guy. Could we make that comp? But really interesting fight. We're both going with Antonina Shevchenko to get the win. Tricky fight. Really looking forward to it. A lightweight big fight for the title. Charles Oliveira taking on Michael Chandler. Holy smokes. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. This is straight up this week's But Why fight. We have it at middleweight. Couple of bangers. Jamie Pickett, the Night Wolf, taking on, and somewhere Chris Farley is rolling in his grave, the Beverly Hills Ninja, Jordan Wright, coming out of Dynamics MMA. And Matt, for Jordan Wright, I mean, the book was kind of out on him before he came into Contender Series. This was a guy that fought a very meager level of competition, but as we like to say with Fight Night Picks, beat those guys the way you want to see them beat. Now, he finished Edward Darby, who was 0-21 at the time, in 10 seconds. He finished Julian Hernandez,
Update on Edward Darby. He is now 0-22 and has not fought since, unfortunately.
Okay. Julian Hernandez is 0-10. I don't think we've checked in on him since, but Wright was able to finish him in 39 seconds. And then, again, first round finish, 0-0, 1-2, 7-3. And then he comes on a Contender Series and he gets beat by Anthony Hernandez, a guy that ended up getting tested positive for the dank herb. And then after that, he beats Gabriel Checo. Now, that's when I went, okay, Jordan Wright crushed cans. And listen, we normally say that, give credit where credit's due and respect. These guys are in the cage against a guy that can finish them. Have I done it? No. That's why I'm talking on YouTube. But Jordan Wright did it. And hell, Craig Wilkerson, John Stern, Julian Hernandez, and Edward Darby sacrificed their bodies for the sport. Now, beating Gabriel Checo, again, that holds water for me. That's a longtime LFA vet, a guy that's fought some very established names. That one checks out. Then he gets his call in the UFC, and he beats Ike Villanueva. Now, did Villanueva have a lot of success up a weight class at 265 against Chase Sherman? No. Did he have a lot of success against Jordan Wright in a fight at light heavyweight where Jordan Wright weighed 200 pounds? No. So Wright finishes that fight. Okay, that's all right. Then he goes in and fights Joaquin Buckley. And it just so happened that that was on Joaquin Buckley's Shadow Realm tour. And Joaquin Buckley put him away. What did you think of that one?
Joaquin Buckley is going to be one of those Tapology pages that you just stumble across in like 20 years. You're like, I remember that guy. Remember 2020? That was the summer of Joaquin Buckley. Now, unfortunately, Jordan Wright was the victim of Joaquin Buckley. And that's my big problem with Jordan Wright. He looks so slow in that fight. I understand Joaquin Buckley. Listen, he's a good striker. He might not be a great striker. De Chirico definitely exposed some of those holes. But still, there is some stuff to like about Jordan. There is some stuff to like about Joaquin Buckley. He's got good speed on the feet. He's got decent power. He doesn't have very good head movement. You wouldn't know that based on his performance against Jordan Wright, though. He looked like he was Anderson Silva in that fight. And it was really off-putting because Jordan Wright, he does what I'm just going to call the Luke Rockhold defense, where it's, I'm going to put my chin really high in the air and back up a lot. Now, I don't know if it's one of those cases where Jordan Wright is a big middleweight. And if you're a big guy, you're going to be used to getting your head out of danger by just leaning back. Fat Joe was able to do it in the early 2000s. I've made that joke multiple times before. But when you are a guy like Jordan Wright, who normally has height on your opponent, you can lean back and get away with that. But the issue is, when guys start to throw a combination, and when you just move backwards, eventually you're going to run out of place to go. And Jordan Wright was unfortunately a victim of that. Now, that was one of the more disgusting stoppages, I think, of 2020. That was one of those fights where Wright gets hurt right at the end of the first round. His corner, or whoever is looking out for his, I guess, future health, probably should have thrown in the towel. He somehow stumbles out there for like 10 seconds and gets absolutely flatlined by Joaquin Buckley. And that's something that worries me. I know that fight was 6 months ago, and that's something we talked about a little bit. Like, where Bonturin fights later, and he's coming back after only 2 months layoff from his last knockout loss. A, when is too early to come back? And for Jordan Wright, like, that was a bad loss, where he did take a lot of damage. Would you like to see him maybe take 2 or 3 more months off? Or is this one of those cases where it kind of sucks you're an unranked fighter and you're just kind of a wheel in the car?
Well, let's talk about the odds to this one, because I think that's where it makes sense. You look at them, you had Pickett opening at a plus 100, Wright open a minus 120, and now they're about the same, around a minus 110. So it's a pick'em fight. Look at it for Jamie Pickett. This is a guy kind of in the same spot. Like, you appear on Contender Series 3 times. He gets submitted by Charles Byrd, no longer in the UFC. He gets beaten by decision by Puna Soriano. And listen, Puna's been in the comment sections on YouTube, so I know he watches Fight Night Picks. And Puna, I'm talking to you. You're a good fighter. Right? You're a good fighter, and if we don't pick you to win, I'm sorry. But you lose to Puna Soriano. Kind of makes sense. Then he beats Jonathan Pate on Contender Series. And listen, Jonathan was, I'd say, slim thick. He wasn't slim thick. He was short thick, fighting at 185. And if you want to see a great finishing sequence, and there's a lot of them out there, a lot of great combos. I mean, hell, Alex Morono looked pretty good last weekend against Cowboy Cerrone. That finishing sequence that Pickett has over Pate, wow. It was like a 30-punch combo. It was great. But if you do watch a lot of Jamie Pickett fights, a lot of great volume, a lot of forward pressure. If he's able to do kind of the Arlovsky rush on you, wow, Jamie Pickett looks like a really good fighter. Unfortunately for him, in his last fight, and I know a lot of people are low on him just based on the fight last week, but Tafan Chukwe, or Tafan went off, and he put on one of those marquee and Chukwe fights where it's a lot of volume, it's a lot of pressure, you know how good his Muay Thai is, and Pickett wasn't really able to kind of withstand that. Chukwe looked great in that fight, Pickett didn't. So now Pickett has to pick up the pieces, and it's been, what, 5 months or so? But for Pickett, he didn't get finished. For Wright, he got finished brutally. And then you look at it, power puncher, volume striker, it is a really tough one to try and figure out. And the last thing I want to say, Matt, for Pickett too, again, Puna Soriano, Charles Byrd, you're going to lose to guys like that. He also lost to Tyler Minton in his MMA debut. But other than that, Brian McGinnis, 4-2. Then Jason Fant, 0-3, 1-2, 1-2, 8-9, 4-2. It's a lot of the same thing for both of these guys where the records aren't really the best. For Pickett, again, a couple of gyms that you don't hear of often, Dynamics MMA. And for Pickett, he's coming out of a gym in North Carolina, Port City Performance. But it's a tricky one. It really is.
And for Pickett, that was a weird fight against Tafan because he gets hurt early and it just felt like he couldn't really get back into the fight after that point. And I do feel like we are going to see a much improved Pickett in this fight. For Wright, I kind of mentioned, he does like to move straight backwards. And when you do move straight back against a guy who can throw in combination with volume, eventually some of those shots are going to catch up to you. If Wright could back up and then move on an angle like we see a lot of other fighters, like Max Holloway is a good example of it. No, I understand that is at the highest level, but still, when you see a guy who can back up and then cut an angle afterwards, I really hate the fact that Jordan Wright does back straight up, and I do think that's going to cost him against really anybody at either 205, 185, who has any kind of power in their hands. I really do.
So like you said, the odds are at about par. We're going to look at Tapology votes. They're surprised us. Ooh. They are to you. 960 of them, 63% going with Wright, 48% roughly going with him to win by knockout. For the 37% that have Pickett, 69% by knockout. Might come as a surprise. The last time he knocked somebody out was actually Jonathan Patti late last year, actually back in August. So there's a method of victory for both guys. We kind of laid it out, but this is one again. It's volatile. The odds are par. So it's not going to be on the question mark kicks parlay. It's a tough read. Maybe you're taking the under 2.5. I think that'd be a decent one. I mean, both guys with finishing abilities, but who are you going with here?
I don't have a lot of confidence in this pick, if I'm being completely honest, but at the end of the day, I do have Jamie Pickett. I just think his volume and his ability to land punches in combinations will eventually catch up with Wright. If Wright goes out there, lands some straight shots like he is capable of doing, listen, like I said, he's a big guy at 185, and he does have good power on the feet, don't get me wrong, but the fact that he's only ever knocked out guys, or at least traditionally only knocks out guys who have like a 1-10 record, isn't that impressive. So I think this is one of those fights that if Jordan Wright can look good in this fight, then hey, I might change my opinion about him completely, but I've got to go with Pickett at the end of the day.
Fight doesn't go to decision right now on a couple different sites, minus 215. There's not odds out yet on over under 2.5 rounds, but there will be, and I'm assuming they'll be in that ballpark, like a minus 185. So for now, you're going to have to wait until question mark kicks. I'm going to go with the under 2.5 rounds, so you're going to have to wait and see how that plays out in the week. Under 2.5 rounds, it's a pick. I can do whatever the hell I want. And then on question mark kicks, I can pick a winner. That's what I'm going with, Matt. You're going with Pickett on this one.
I am.
Big fight coming up this weekend at middleweight and in our main event, Matt, at lightweight for the title. Michael Chandler taking on Charles Oliveira. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Interesting fight coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have, well, Superman never made any money saving the world from Solomon Grundy. Matt, I'll say that, and I'll out that Crash Test Dummies lyric. Canada's own, but for Mike Grundy, really interesting career. This is a guy that medaled at the Commonwealth Games in freestyle wrestling. You know exactly what you're going to get just about every single time out. Even Nad Nariamani found out, former Cage Warriors champ. And then for Mike Grundy, his last fight, well, that was the first time he lost since he lost way, way back when to Damian Stasiak. And for Stasiak, that was Poland's hit it right off a tee, and Stasiak made it to the UFC off a win over Mike Grundy. So Grundy went on a great big win streak, beats Nad Nariamani, loses last time out to Mavzar Evloev. That was a fun fight. And you really want to know something crazy. Mike Grundy, he'll take you down, take you down, take you down. His numbers were high. His numbers are really high in that Evloev fight. He took him down 6 times officially on the UFC's website. And that's kind of crazy. We know Evloev for the crazy scrambles and his own takedowns. Mike Grundy took him down 6 times.
It's a really impressive stat. And with Mike Grundy, this fight, again, I got to say this. This would be Mike Goldberg's favorite fight on the card. Because what is it, Craig? It's a clash of styles. Now, Lando Venata, I guess I'll start with him. Because I'll raise my hand as I was one of those really dumb people who bought a lot of stock of Lando Venata.
That's dumb, hey, hey.
I was one of those people who was like, hey, he dropped Tony Ferguson. He could probably drop everyone else in the lightweight division. I was very wrong in that prediction. Now, we have seen the limitations of Lando Venata's skill set, but there was a point where people thought Lando Venata was like the dark horse of dark horses in the UFC. He was one of those early Joe Rogan's favorites. And listen, we talk about this not all the time, but you can gain stock in a loss. And I don't think anyone's gained more stock in a loss than Lando Venata over that Tony Ferguson loss. Because, yeah, he got choked out by a Darce choke. He also dropped Ferguson with a head kick, hit him with a bunch of spinning stuff, and it was one of the greatest short fights of all time. This fight will be interesting because we've seen Lando Venata, at least for the past few years, he hasn't been prospect Lando Venata. He's not on his way up Lando Venata. He's just kind of become like middle of the pack Lando Venata. And it's really weird because even back in the day when, you know, he was losing, I was still always on the side of like, hey, if Venata can at least sort of get it together, he's going to be able to go on a run. But we've seen the limitations of his skill set. Yes, he has a lot of great spinning techniques, but is his boxing that great? It's okay on the inside. I just feel like with Venata, a lot of what he does well is the fact that he is so unique. But the fact is, in MMA right now, everyone is kind of unique. I don't think Lando Venata is this, like, oddity anymore. I think there's other guys who can kind of fight like him. And I think we've seen Lando Venata start to get beat on the feet. My issue is that
Listen, if you go out there and out-grapple Lando Venata, it's kind of the same excuse that McGregor has if he gets out-grappled. It's like, well, at least I didn't get knocked out. Then we saw Bobby Green drop him on the feet. Then we saw Marcio Casio strike him. I'm just worried that we've seen the limitations of Lando Venata's striking. Because in my mind, I think he has the potential to be like Edson Barboza-level striker. I realize that's not the case anymore, and I do think we've kind of seen where his skill set can go. This is a very long-winded way of saying, I think we've seen Lando Venata improve as much as he's going to improve. I feel like he's kind of plateaued at this point. So the real question is, can Lando Venata, who is still a decent fighter, don't get me wrong, but is the Lando Venata who, yeah, he lost a few fights, can that guy beat Mike Grundy, who's going to go out there and look for the takedown consistently? And that's the fun thing about this fight. Lando Venata, he's really only fought primary strikers throughout the majority of his UFC career, so we'll be really interesting to see him in there with a guy who stylistically is so opposite of himself.
Mike Grundy is a UFC fighter. I mean, he's had a broken jaw. He was supposed to fight Nick Lentz back at the start of the year, back in January, but one of his corners tested positive for COVID, so he couldn't fight Nick Lentz. And who did Nick Lentz get? Mavzar Evliev, and Mavzar ended his career promptly. But I look at their overall careers, and for Lando Venata, 3-5-2 in the UFC, you look at the wins. He put John McDessie on a poster. Oh. He went out there. He had that win over... Listen, you talk about hyped up prospects. Marcos Mariano is one of those guys. Go do a little bit of a deep dive. This was Anderson Silva's protege. This guy was supposed to be good at 6-3 coming into the UFC. Then he lost two fights and he was gone. You've never heard of him since. You probably even never heard of him. This might be the first time. Well, Lando Venata had him in a Kimura in the first round, finished him. Then he lost to Jacasey. Then he beat a long in the tooth 155 Yancy Medeiros.
Yeah, bad fight, which is weird because going into
nobody wanted to strike.
Yeah, exactly. Going into that fight, it's like, okay, Yancy Medeiros might not be a top 15 guy, but like, he fights Lando Venata. I know what I'm going to be watching. And then it was like, oh, so you're both wrestlers now?
Yeah, it wasn't a good fight. That's going to be a drop soon. And then the Bobby Green fight, it was kind of close, right? Like, it was close, not as close as their draw that they had before, but it was a fight to kind of hang your hat on. It was a fight of the night performance. And that's the other thing for Lando Venata. He came in with so much steam to the UFC that he was able to rack up 4 bonuses, bang, bang. And then it took him a while, and then he had a fight of the night against Bobby Green. For Mike Grundy, coming out of Team Cowboy, has a wrestling pedigree. You know he's going to wrestle. You know, obviously, Lando Venata has been training, drilling the wrestling. I've seen Kevin Aguilar in some of the picks on the socials. It'll be interesting to see the game plan that the Jackson Wink crew have for Lando Venata, because when you fight a guy like Mike Grundy, it's pretty hard to be flashy and exciting.
Exactly, and every time Venata is going to try to create that space to really let off one of his crazy kicks, what's a great way to defend a kick? Grab it and take the guy down. He's probably not going to try throwing those kicks again. And with Grundy, he's one of those smart grapplers too. He isn't just going to let the opponent jump up to his feet because he's getting sloppy going for a submission. He does have great submissions, don't get me wrong. This isn't my way of saying he's like Jake Shields, but he's a smart enough grappler that if he does get Venata down to the mat, I think he will make the most of it. Now, it will be interesting because Lando Venata in the Matt Frivola fight, I thought he beat him. I'll be honest, I think Matt Frivola's lost a few of his close fights that he's had in the UFC, but that was a time where we did see Venata at least defend a few takedowns. He did well in that fight, but again, I do think Mike Grundy is he's a different fighter, I guess, than Matt Frivola, but I think he's a much more control-based fighter than Frivola is, and for all those reasons, I actually like Grundy in this fight. I do think Grundy's one of those fighters who is going to continue to improve, whereas Venata, we knew him for the flashiness. We like him because, listen, Venata can be in a fight of the night with really anybody. But Kenny, that's the problem. I just think Venata on the feet, he's a much more hesitant striker than he used to be. I think he's eaten some damage. I just don't think it's the same fighter who had that crazy fight against David Tamor. I don't think it's the same fighter who had the crazy fight against Ferguson or Green the first time. I just don't think it's the same Lando Venata, and it sucks to say because I bought a lot of stock in Lando Venata when he first moved over into the UFC. But at the end of the day, I do think Mike Grundy's going to have his number.
Venata fought at welterweight in Pancrase in 2013, but he's a lightweight. This fight's at featherweight, so again, it sways it even more in the way of Grundy. For me, maybe Lando Venata goes out and defends a lot of the takedowns, maybe gets flashy with the striking. It's such a tough stylistic matchup for him. And then I look at the odds. Grundy opened at minus 135, is a minus 120. Lando Venata opened at plus 115, is a minus 103. And then I have a look at the Tapology votes, and surprise to me as it is to you, 994 total votes, 63% Grundy, 37% Venata. I am surprised by that because I like Mike Grundy in this fight. So the fans going with Grundy. The bettors are kind of siding with Venata a little bit. And listen, I love a Lando Venata fight. I'm sure you at home love it too. I know Matt does. But I don't know, at 45, it seems like a Grundy fight, like, not easy, but kind of easy.
No, I couldn't agree more. I just think Vanata, listen, he's been hesitant against strikers, so now against a guy who's only going to be looking to take him down, he's going to be that much more hesitant with his strikes, so I just think it's going to be a really tough night out for Vanata. Like you had said, if he can defend some of those early takedowns, get the confidence up early, because I do think that's what it comes down to with Vanata. If he can get that confidence boosted earlier on in this fight, then I do think he will let his hands go a little bit more, and that'll give him a much higher chance of landing a big shot, but no, I do agree, I've got Grundy.
Both of us going with Mike Grundy coming out of England to get the win. Really looking forward to the fight. And if you move it up a notch and you go to lightweight, co-main event, Tony Ferguson taking on Beneil Dariush, and in the main event, Michael Chandler taking on Charles Oliveira for the belts. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Middleweight showcase fight coming up this weekend. We have Ronaldo Jacare Souza, the former Strikeforce king. And he's taking on a guy whose first name is just like one of my favorite basketball players of all time. And yes, you have to understand the area in which I grew up. I'm talking about Andrea Bargnani. We have Andrea Muniz. And Matt, for Muniz, this is a guy that I've had the hardest time getting a read on straight up in the UFC. He came in off of the Brazilian Contender Series. He gets a big win over Bruno Assis. And then he has to get another win over Taylor Johnson. And then he's in the UFC, and he fights Antonio Hoyo. And I looked at it, and I went, okay, Andrea Muniz is the smaller man, and he doesn't really strike all that well. Hoyo's going to beat him. Nope, I was totally wrong. And then Andrea Muniz went out, and he fought Bartosz Fabinski not that long ago. And I went, okay, it's jiu-jitsu against judo. Andrea Muniz has great defensive submissions. Bartosz Fabinski leaves his head out. But he's great at judo, and sometimes he absolutely mops the floor with guys, like when he fought Darren Stewart. Method of victory for Muniz, defensive submission. Method of victory for Fabinski, lay and pray and stay heavy. And what did Bartosz do? Left his head out there, got caught in a submission. They got back up. And then Muniz ended up submitting him in the end. And this is a guy that, wow, his stock's risen. But not just in Craig Allen or Matt Allen's eyes or the fans' eyes. But in the UFC's eyes, enough to give him from Antonio Ahoyo, a guy that lost to Deron Wynn in a terrible fight, to then a fight against Bartosz Fabinski to now a legend in Jacare Souza. It's crazy.
Jacare Souza fighting Andrea Muniz is kind of like when you saw Hakeem Olajuwon in a Raptors jersey. It's like, okay, I knew things were getting bad, but they're this bad?
Let's keep the references coming.
Because it's weird. Like, Jacare, okay, I know he's 1-4 in his last five, but you have to understand who he's been losing to. Like, you can lose to Kevin Holland off of your back. Okay, maybe that's not the best way to lose, but still, he has that weird, kind of fluky, kind of really cool loss, if we're being honest, to Kevin Holland. He lost to Kelvin Gastelum, but still, losing to guys like that, and even Jack Hermanson, like, that doesn't tell me that you've completely fallen off yet. I'm telling you this right now. Jacare loses to Andrea Muniz. He's not winning another win. He's not winning another fight in the UFC. Because here's the thing. We talked about this, well, before we even started shooting. Muniz has one way to win this fight. Yes, he's a third-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. Yes, he's great on the mat. I'm telling you this right now. It's not like Jacare is like a Rodolfo Vieira, where I'm worried that he's going to get tired, and that there's a world out there where Jacare could get submitted. I'm telling you this right now. Jacare is not going to get submitted by Andrea Muniz. There is not a world, there is not any situation where Muniz outgrapples Jacare in this fight. I understand people are going to be selling your wolf tickets. They're going to say, hey, if anyone can do it, it's Muniz. But here's the thing. I've heard this once before. I heard that Yoel Romero was going to outgrapple Jacare. He outstruck him. I've heard Chris Weidman was going to outgrapple Jacare. It didn't happen. Jacare outstruck him. Jacare only really loses by getting knocked out. You can't out-grapple him. You can't go out there and out-volume him, really. The majority of the time you beat Jacare is you finish him on the feet. Now, I don't know why Craig's reacting
except
like that.
Except for Jack Hermanson.
Okay, but Jack Hermanson has a lot of volume. Jack Hermanson and Andrea Muniz don't have many similarities in their game, and that's the thing. Muniz is a great grappler, but my argument is that he's going to have to find success grappling against arguably the best grappler to ever go into MMA. This fight is a lot like Tatiana Suarez versus Carlos Esparza, where it's, hey, I'm very good at this one thing, but you're great at this one thing, and I do think this can be one of those cases where, hey, Andrea Muniz might be good at jiu-jitsu, but you're dealing with a guy in Jacare who's widely considered as one of the all-time greats, and for good reason. Jacare's not just good at jiu-jitsu in the game, or outside of the green. He's great at jiu-jitsu and MMA, and at the end of the day, I think that's what you need to beat a guy like Andrea Muniz. The weird thing about Muniz, though, is that all of his losses are by TKO KO, which is a little bit concerning because Jacare is a guy who, A, he has phenomenal ground and pound, and B, Jacare on the feet is still a bit of a problem. I understand the durability might not be there like it once was, but when Jacare is moving forward on people, he still has big power. The only issue is he doesn't really have the output, especially in a five-round atmosphere, but the great thing for Jacare is that this is only a three-round fight against a Kyle Mooney's, I don't want to say a limited fighter, but a fighter who just isn't all that dynamic. He's going to do a lot of the same things Jacare does well. So at the end of the day, I have to ask myself, can Mooney's out-grapple Jacare? I don't think so. Can Jacare out-grapple Mooney's? I'm fairly certain about it.
It's such a weird fight, straight up. And for Jacare Souza, Fusion XL, he's been there for a while now. Why? Why? Like, training with Rodolfo Vieira? That's it. It's Jacare BJJ, and it's Fusion XL. Like, they have such coaches as Matt Schroy. You know who Matt Schroy is? Go look him up on HockeyDB. Tons of penalty minutes in the minor leagues, and I think it's a cat's ass that he's a coach there, and I'd love to interview him because it'd be a great interview. Hockey? MMA? I mean, listen, that's the stuff that gets me up in the morning. But when I look at this fight, again, you're right. Jacare, good striker. Look at the wins. He finished Tim Boach. He lost to Robert Whittaker. He finished Eric Brunson, the hometown, close to hometown type of fight. He loses a Gaslam split decision, close fight. He beats a really tough out in Weidman, but that was a weird fight, and he finished him brutally. Then he loses to Hermanson by unanimous decision in a fight where he kind of got out everything. That was a really weird fight. And then he loses to Blachowicz, where Jacare pushed the pace, and it was one of the more boring fights you've ever seen at 205 pounds. And then he gets knocked out by Kevin Holland, and it's like, whoa, perspective shift. Now, what happened to Jacare? Because, again, the three fights in a row, Hermanson, you get totally outdone. Hermanson's kind of wishy-washy. Like, he can be kind of tough to get a read on, not fighting Edmund Shahbazyan this weekend anymore. But then the last two, again, Kevin Holland hype train. But again, it was a good win for Holland. It was a great punch. It was good for him. And then the Blachowicz fight was just an oddity. And we know how good he is. So it is a tricky one. But for Muniz, again, Ahoyo, Bartosz Fabinski, regional fights. It's really tough to get an accurate read. And then when you factor in the odds to this one, they kind of weird me out. So really, the overall take here is the fact that Jacare is one of the greatest fighters to ever do it. Andrea Muniz is trying to get a win like that. And Andrea Muniz right now, open a plus 100, he's a minus 110. And for Jacare, he opened up around a minus 120, he's a minus 130. The money's coming in on Andrea Muniz. And then we look at the fan vote, 1,040 total votes, 53% Souza, 47% Muniz. I don't know if people know something I don't know. I don't love three-fight win streaks, as evidenced by, and if you haven't watched it, please do, but I took Shevchenko to beat Lee. But in this fight, a guy that's 1-4 in his last five, I still find myself drawn to that guy. Now, is it the guy that I used to know? Maybe it is. Maybe Muniz is the guy that kind of finally puts that nail in the coffin. I had Cerrone to win last weekend. Look how silly that turned out. But I still do favor Jacare in a fight like this.
Listen, if Jacare can't win this, it's it for him. And that's just the honest truth. Like, if you get outstruck by Muniz and knocked out, then it's over. If you get out-grappled by him, listen, you're Jacare Souza. And really, the only thing that's still getting us so hyped about his fights is his grappling acumen. So if Jacare is able to win this fight, then I do still think there's a few other fights out there that could be exciting for him. But yes, I will pick Jacare at the end of the day.
Matt, both of us going with the Brazilian. The Brazilian, the Jacare Souza, and I'm really looking forward to this fight. We have a great lineup of fights on this card, headlined by Charles Oliveira from Brazil, taking on Michael Chandler for the vacant belt. You're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Possible fight of the night coming up this weekend at featherweight. We have Hurricane Shane Burgos taking on Edson Barboza. Two of the more dynamic strikers you're going to find at 145. You get the crisp boxing of Shane Burgos, the guy out of Tiger Schulman's. And you saw a big win for Tiger Schulman's gym last weekend with Mike Trezano getting the upset over Ludovic Klein. And whether or not you disagree with that, for Burgos, for Trezano, for Julio Arce, for Jimmy Rivera, a great wealth of knowledge at the gym and a great amount of training partners there. In a gym that we don't really hear about. And for Edson Barboza, we've seen him kind of bounce around from gym to gym in his career. But he has spent a lot of time at ATT. You see the pictures on the Instagrams with some of the big names. Recently, even Mateusz Gamrot. But for Edson Barboza, the move down, was it necessitated by the losses at lightweight? I really don't know. Was it an easier path to go for a title? He moves down, he loses to Dan Ige, and then his last time out, he absolutely blew the brakes off Makwan Amirkhani. It wasn't even close. I love this fight, man.
This fight is so exciting for so many different reasons. So I guess I'll just start with Edson Barboza. So he has those two losses at 155 and then decides, okay, I'm going to move down to 145. Gets that fight against Dan Ige, and I know I've said it 1,000 times, but I'm going to say it again. He beat Dan Ige. There you go. I'm glad we got that out of the way. So Edson Barboza is on a two-fight winning streak at 145. He beat Dan Ige in my world. We're just going to keep on saying that. And then he destroyed Makwan Amirkhani in one of the more one-sided fights of all time. Now, I don't think we can learn a lot from that Makwan fight just because, listen, what did Edson do? Defended a bunch of takedowns and outstruck a guy who isn't that good of a striker in MMA. And if you're not good at striking in MMA against Edson Barboza, I have very bad news for you. You're probably going to get hurt. And we saw Edson Barboza just completely dominate that fight on the feet. With Shane Burgos, though, it's interesting. He's a very hittable fighter, which we don't often talk about when you talk about fighters who are at the top of the rankings. And those, I guess you talk about them when you talk about fighters who are exciting, but not really technically sound fighters. But Shane Burgos, he does have really good boxing. He has great boxing combinations, and he's one of those fighters who, when he is really putting his combinations together in flurries of punches, he's extremely hard to deal with because at a certain point, his offense is such a good defense that he gets guys to shell up because he is throwing so much. But then you saw in his fight against Josh Emmett, and I understand, not a lot of guys have Josh Emmett types of power, but just go back to that fight. Josh Emmett on one ACL was able to outbox Shane Burgos. That's a little concerning for a guy who is widely regarded as a great boxer, but I've got to say what I say a lot. He's not a great boxer. If Shane Burgos was a great boxer in MMA, he wouldn't be as hittable as he is. And that's one of the first things I think about when I think about Shane Burgos. We can talk about the hand speed. We can talk about what I'd consider kind of underrated power, if you will, out of Shane Burgos. But my problem is that Shane Burgos is a very hittable fighter. And at the end of the day, when you're fighting guys at 145, like Edson Barboza, like Josh Emmett, like the Calvin Caters of the world, even like Max Holloway's and Zabit's as you move up the rankings, I'm just saying, there's a lot of guys who you don't want to be hittable against in this division. And I do think if we see some of the holes that we saw in that Josh Emmett fight, and the fact that Emmett was able to land so many overhand rights clean on Shane Burgos, if Edson Barboza is landing clean on Shane Burgos, I don't care if it's with the kicks or with the punches, he's going to hurt Shane Burgos, and he's probably going to hurt him away. So I think the most important X factor about this whole fight really comes down to the defense of Shane Burgos.
Yeah, when you look at it, and especially with that Burgos fight, it was a fight of the night against Josh Emmett. Emmett had the two knockdowns in the final round. 10-8, maybe. I mean, he almost doubled his output. Definitely in that one. Like, he did a really good job there. He had the control time. In the first and second rounds, I mean, Burgos was able to, in terms of volume, outstrike. But again, it was a great fight. It was a really fun one. And then if you look at the overall body of work for these two guys, it's really impressive to see the names. Now, for Burgos, he pieced up Makwan Amirkhani and finished him. Before that, Cub Swanson, great split decision win. Before that, Kurt Hollabaugh. You don't really hear about him in the UFC.
Weird fight, though, too, for Shane Burgos, because Burgos gets dropped with the first punch that Hollabaugh lands on him, and then he armbars Hollabaugh off his back, which is kind of the opposite that you would expect a Shane Burgos fight to go. So, for Burgos, I do think there is this other part of his game that we haven't really at least got the chance to see yet, and he might be one of those fighters who's like, hey, I'm just so comfortable with my hands, we will never see that really grappling side of him. But I think we might probably see a takedown from Shane Burgos in this fight, because that's the really weird thing. He is so boxing heavy, and he doesn't have kicks of his own. If you're a kicking range, or if you are at distance with Edson Barboza, in all those kind of stalling, I'll just say stalling, but in those moments where neither guy's going to be doing much on the outside, just kind of bouncing, Edson Barboza can fill those sort of empty spaces of time with leg kicks and with jabs. The thing is, if Shane Burgos in all that sort of empty space is just eating leg kicks constantly, I don't know which version of Shane Burgos we're going to get in that second and third round. Because if you look at the Barboza who went out there and beat Dan Hooker, and listen, I think that was one of those fights where it was Edson Barboza on one of his best days against Dan Hooker on one of his worst. If that Edson Barboza fights Shane Burgos, I don't think Shane Burgos has much of a chance in this fight. But the problem with Barboza is that if you do pressure him a lot, eventually you can get to him. So I cannot tell you just how excited I am for this fight. Because it comes down to, can Burgos pressure and, I guess, eat enough damage from Edson Barboza until he finally gets to Barboza to where he can land some of his boxing combinations? Or does Barboza just counter him on the inside and completely tear him up with kicks on the outside? This fight's so entertaining.
When you look at it for Shane Burgos, the takedown defense is great. 89%, 100% on his takedowns given. And listen, there haven't been many of them, about three in his overall career. He knows when to shoot them. He knows exactly how to defend the takedowns. And then the other thing that's telling, strikes landed per minute, 7.31 to 5.81 absorbed for Burgos. Those are crazy amounts for both. And then for Barboza, 3.98 given to 4.03 taken. Defense about the same for both guys. The accuracy a little bit better for Shane Burgos, but again, you got to consider the level of competition for both guys, the two different weight classes. When we look at the odds, Burgos open to minus 120. He's a minus 129 favorite right now. For Barboza, open to plus 100. He's at about a plus 105. And if we look at the total Tapology votes, it's a bit of a surprise. 1,131 of them, 59% Barboza, 53% having to win by decision, 40% by knockout, 41% have Burgos to win, 59% by decision, 35% by knockout. Matt, I absolutely love the fight. You got the 30-year-old Burgos just turned 30. You've got Barboza at 35. And again, for Burgos, the last time he was out was against Josh Emmett almost a year ago. It was 10 months ago. It's crazy that we haven't seen him in this long.
It's probably for the best, honestly. He did eat a lot of damage in that fight. Highly recommend you go back and watch Shane Burgos versus Josh Emmett. One of the great fights of last year, it really was. At the end of the day, though, I do think I have to pick Edson Barboza, because this is the thing people don't talk about enough when they talk about Edson Barboza. He's a good boxer himself on the inside, and he's actually great at landing with combinations, especially when his opponent's moving forward on him. So if you're a guy with Barboza who can land to the body, land to the legs, which is just water in the basement for later on in the fight, and if you can withstand the early storm from Burgos, there's just a lot to like from Edson Barboza in this fight. I like the kicks. I do like the variety of shots with his punches. And here's the other thing. I actually think Barboza probably has more power in his hands than Shane Burgos does. Now, Burgos can land with combination a lot better. He's a lot more fluid with his boxing than Edson Barboza is. But for one-punch power, I'm here to tell you, Edson Barboza probably hits harder than Shane Burgos. So at the end of the day, I will pick Barboza in what will probably be one of the best fights we've seen in a very long time.
I like Barboza with the complete arsenal, the complete attack. But again, you did see it out of Burgos' corner or you know, one of his training partners in Trezano. Well, how do I really stifle a good kickboxer? I just pressure the hell out of him and don't let him get off on anything. Now, again, a lot of people saw that different ways. Truth be told, I had a 29-28 Trezano, but
Ludwig Klein, Edson Barboza.
And Shane Burgos a lot higher than Mike Trezano on that scale, too. It's got to be said. But this is a really good fight. I do like Barboza with the complete game, but it is tricky. And if you like Burgos, I want to hear from you down below in the comment section.
And we would make this a fight of the night if we didn't think it was going to be competitive. Like, we haven't just gone on here and said, yeah, Edson Barboza is going to knock him out quick. Like, again, Shane Burgos is absurdly durable, and so is Edson Barboza. So no matter who's having success, it's not like the other guy is just going to fold because of it. And I think that's what makes this fight so fun.
Absolutely love the fight. Both of us going with Edson Barboza to get the win. Can't wait for the rest of this card. Dariush, Ferguson, Chandler, Oliveira, all kinds of great fights. You're going to want to check them out. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Great fight at the top of the women's flyweight division. We have blonde fighter Caitlin Chukagan. You can bet she's going to rock DMX. She does every single fight. Taking on Viviane Araújo. And this is Striker's Paradise. We love it. We've had the opportunity to see a few fights like this on the card. But with Caitlin Chukagan, it's a lot of volume. It's a lot of backing up. It's a lot of stick and move. A lot of the fundamentals that you like to see, you just rarely do see because people tend to get a little sloppy. But as the fights go on, Caitlin Chukagan is always there. And since she's really made the move to Nick Cantone's MMA, you see the Henzo Gracie connection, she's kind of rounded her game out. We saw that in the Antonina Shevchenko fight. It was like, oh, we're strikers? Well, I'm a wrestler now, so I've got that trap card. And for Viviane Araújo, you look at her last five fights, and it's very impressive. It is. She was great over in Pancrase. She comes into the UFC, and you rarely ever see Pancrase translate to the UFC, but she comes in, finishes Talita Bernardo, beats Alexis Davis, tough, durable Canadian, and Alexis did win a round in that fight. And then you go and you look, she loses Jessica Ai in a weird fight where that wasn't a regular Viviane Araújo fight. It wasn't. She can get tired in certain fights. She got tired in that one. Beats Montana De La Rosa handily, beats Roxanne Modafferi. Now we're here. For Araújo, a lot of power in the striking, a lot of expended energy as we're going on. And with Caitlin Chukagan, again, pretty good gas tank, pretty much the same thing every time. Again, 3-2 in her last five, the two losses we talked about. Valentina Shevchenko for the title, and Jessica Andrade, who just challenged for the title. Which fight was worse? I don't know. I mean, that Andrade fight was kind of bad.
It was bad.
It was bad. But really, you know what you're going to get out of both of these fighters. I'm eager to see this matchup because it's something that we haven't seen in this division, and I'm really eager to get your thoughts because, again, it is a striker's paradise.
It is, and it's a fresh matchup at the top of the division, which is really all anybody can ask for. With Araújo, it's interesting because I think we were both too sold on her hype, and I think I might have sold my stocks, and you might still hold on to a few of them. I'm kidding, of course, but Araújo was one of those fighters who you could get excited for. It's not like there's a ton of
knock. I still
can. Well, okay, but you have to taper your expectations, and that's my whole point. With Araújo, she was a fighter you get excited for because you don't see a lot of standing knockouts in the women's divisions. And the fact that she was able to go out there and basically starch Bernardo with one punch in the third round was really impressive. And then she has another great performance against Alexis Davis, who, yes, she isn't title challenger Alexis Davis anymore, but she's, again, one of those fighters who I'd kind of talked to when we had referenced Randa Markos earlier. Beating Alexis Davis is a very important kind of step that a lot of fighters have to get over. You have to beat that wily veteran. Arusha was able to do that. And I was like, wow, okay. They matched up with Jessica Ai. Like, she's been able to beat the brakes off Jessica Ai. But I think we saw a weird hole in Arusha's game. You had said that it was an off night up for Arusha. I'm only going to offer this slight other excuse, if you will. I just think Arusha has really good technique. And when fighters make an ugly on her, she has that, I always reference LeBron James in the finals, but she almost overthinks it. I do think when a fighter tries to make it really ugly against someone who does have really nice technique, when they're not used to everything being coming at them in straight shots and not everything's coming at them with perfect technique, they can get overwhelmed, which I did think Arusha just got overwhelmed by the forward pressure of Jessica Ai in that fight. And trust me, no one likes to, I guess, discredit Jessica Ai more.
Here we go, evil. Here we go.
I do think Jessica Ai just looked good in that fight. But the great thing is that Arusha was able to fix up those holes, and she's looked really good in her last two performances. You had kind of alluded to it, though. She's not Christos Yagos. Her gas tank isn't that bad, but she is one of those fighters who she's got to get the bulk of her work done in those first two rounds, and then she'll kind of coast in that third round. And that's what really concerns me against Caitlin Chookagian, because if fights were 10 rounds, I think Caitlin Chookagian would probably look the exact same in the first round as she would in the 10th round. Great cardio for a fighter, and not just good cardio in one aspect, too. Good grappling cardio and good striking cardio. This is a fighter who could be on her bike for 10 minutes of a fight, flicking out the jab, catching it with counter shots on the way in, and then all of a sudden, when she wants to switch up the game plan, oh, I'm a wrestler now, and she goes for those body lock takedowns. And I don't think people have given credit to Caitlin Chookagian's grappling throughout her career. I know in the Shevchenko fight, she really was showing it more in the cage than we had seen, but this is a fighter who's been with Matt Serra, who did train with the Dana her death squad. Like, she's a fighter who does have a really nice grappling background that I just think people often forget about because she is such a striking heavy MMA fighter. But for Caitlin Chookagian, I think she's gonna be stuck in this weird division and she's gonna be stuck in a weird position in this division for a long time, because I do think Caitlin Chookagian is better than probably all but two, maybe even three of the fighters in this division. My only problem is that she's just kind of going to be stuck behind Andrade and Valentina Shevchenko until either they give up the belt or stop fighting the division completely. Because I honestly think Caitlin Chookagian is by far the third best fighter in this division.
Yeah.
And I'm a person who, I don't think Caitlin Chookagian was that great for a while, but I've come to the point where I just respect what she does. On the feet, she can just outstrike you. And yes, it might not be the most aesthetically pleasing type of striking. Yes, it might not be a Max Holloway versus Calvin Kattar type of striking, but it gets the job done. And at the end of the day, W's are all that matters. And that's what Caitlin Chookagian has been racking up a lot of at 125.
Chookagian outstruck Cynthia Calvillo by 9 shots at the same percentage. Calvillo was able to get a takedown, but only 1 of 4 in a fight where Chookagian won at all three judges, having a 30-27. Really weird fight. Really, really frustrating fight. Because you might have thought, oh, Chookagian, you know, she's coming back off that loss. But before that, she looked really good. And then we got that fight. For Viviane Arujo, her last fight, again, Roxanne Modafferi, a really, really tough out. And if you really like Viviane Arujo and you want the knockouts, it's been a little bit of time. She looked great against Montana De La Rosa, unanimous decision win there. She totally outstruck Modafferi. She took her down 4 or 5 times. She defended. She did everything she needed to do. One of the judges, 30-26, the other two, 30-27. So for Arujo, she did look really good in that fight. And if you like her, I can't stop you. Like, I do have a hard time with this one. I like the positional awareness of Caitlin Chookagian. I like the fact that she can fight off her back foot. She can fight moving forward. She can probably fight up in space. That seems to be a thing now, like fights up in space. We'll see if that space promotion fights takes off. But I look at this one, Matt. It's tricky. Chookagian, open minus 135, favorite minus 139 right now. For Arujo, open plus 115. She's close. I mean, the odds haven't really changed since they opened. If we have a look at Topology, little bit of a surprise to me. 1,100 total votes on the nose. 69% Chookagian, 31% Arujo. For Chookagian, 90% by decision. For Arujo, 85% by decision. So the fans are going with Chookagian. She's a slight favorite in this fight. What are you thinking?
I'm siding with the fans on this one. Caitlin Chookagian just knows how to win decisions. It's a weird thing to say, but it's the truth. Like you had mentioned, in some of her fights, you'll look and the stats will be close. But at the end of the thing, it's like, oh, 30-27 on all three judges' scorecards. That's weird. That fight felt close. But Caitlin Chookagian, there's just something about her style that the judges really like. I don't know if it's the fact that she does just throw a lot of volume. Yes, it might not all land, but just the fact that she's throwing a lot while her opponents kind of stand there and don't do much, I think it just tends to give her the edge during the rounds. So at the end of the day, I do have to side with Caitlin Chookagian.
Both of us. I am as well going with the blonde fighter in this one. I think, again, the little improvements here and there, if she can really work the volume, but Viviane Arujo has that. She has great takedown, she has great power. If the gas tank holds, Arujo can definitely get a win. I love this fight, but again, I'm going with Chookagian. You're going Chookagian. We've got a great card. You're not going to want to miss our co-main and main event videos. The lightweight title on the line in the main event. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. All action type of fight coming up this weekend at Flyweight. We have Danger. Matt Schnell, it's not Gina Mazzani, taking on Rogerio Bontarina. Matt, I love this fight. There are a couple of people out there in the DMs at Fight Night Picks. Hey guys, early pick. You haven't done any tape study. Who are you going with? Well, A, I hate responding to those because if you're wrong, then you look like a total tool. But really, I look at this fight. This is one of the hardest fights to predict all weekend because for Bontarina, what does the guy do well? He's got bombs in his hands. He's a good wrestler. He's a good grappler. And sometimes he gets outstruck and outgrappled. And for Matt Schnell, the same can apply. Like, these guys are kind of consistent, but kind of not. But they always bring it. I love the fight.
This is a really, really fun fight down at Flyweight. And I know we might be the biggest Flyweight fans on YouTube. Flyweight never die over here at Fight Night Picks. Because Matt Schnell and Rogerio Bontarina, two guys who can get the finish, not only on the feet, but on the mat as well. And that's what's so interesting about this matchup. These guys could strike for 15 minutes. They could grapple for 15 minutes. They could stand in the mirror and look at each other 15 minutes. Now, I doubt it's going to be a boring fight. I really do have high hopes for this fight. Because just look at both guys last time out there. Matt Schnell was in there with Tyson Nam, who I think we might be a little too hot on Tyson Nam sometimes, but still a very, very good striker. And Matt Schnell went out there and outstruck him. If you would have asked me out of 100 fights, how would Matt Schnell beat Tyson Nam? I would say 78 of them, he outgrapples them. In those other 12, I would say, okay, well, Tyson Nam is bound to win at least 22. A couple, or 22. Tyson Nam is probably going to win at least one. And then out of the few, I would say maybe Matt Schnell outstrikes him, but the fact that Schnell was able to not only outstrike him, but just work behind the jab and just look so fundamentally sound on the feet was a really nice thing to see out of Matt Schnell's camp. Because for Schnell, I knew how good he was in grappling. I knew he had decent power on the feet, but I never saw the confidence on the feet. And mainly every time he got hit on the feet too, he would get wobbled. But in that Tyson Nam fight, well, his chin looked good. He got hit clean by a guy who is known for putting guys out at that division. And his striking looked great. So I do think Matt Schnell is one of those fighters. And I'll be honest, I had a bad read on him early on. And I do think he has made those improvements ever since. Because Schnell, earlier on in his career, he was a little bit green. He was great at jiu-jitsu, but that was about it. But I do think we've seen a fighter who's definitely made those improvements ever since. And that's just a great thing to see because there's so many fighters who we harp on. Listen, you see the same version of them in their first UFC fight to the last UFC fight. I do think Schnell's a fighter who's definitely improved fight over fight over fight.
The thing that scares you with Matt Schnell is the finish losses. Rob Font, Hector Sandoval, Pantoja, all right, 125, all right. Rob Font's got great hands, just ask Marlon Moraes, but when I look at it, yeah, Matt Schnell can get outstruck, but then he can outgrapple a lot of guys. I mean, Jordan Espinoza finished him in the first round. Luis Smolka finished him in the first round. Beat Naoki Inoue, a guy that I'd like to see back in the UFC. He only had a few fights, and then it was like, all right, see you later. But he'd be a great guy to have back. And then Marco Beltran, he was able to beat by decision. He was on the Ultimate Fighter Season 24. The weird thing for Schnell, ATT guy on a lot of the internet, but now he's training at Fortis MMA a lot with Aaron Phillips. And I think Phillips is a good guy to train with, especially for the stand-up. You're really going to mix it up. Getting ready for a guy like Nam, that's the perfect guy to have in your corner to get ready for. For Bontarin, maybe not coming out of the biggest name gym that you've ever seen, Gil Ribeiro Gym, but you look at the wins. Let's focus on those. So he comes in on Contender Series, and hey, are Contender Series fighters always the best? Sometimes they are. Right now, they're not. But he beat Gustavo Gabriel, who was, what, 13-0. Then he fights Magomed Bibulatov, a guy that I'd love to see still in the UFC too. You look at some of the moves that Bontarin made in that fight. Absolutely insane. Wins that one by splits. Beats Haulian Paiva. Again, his eyebrow kind of just escaped him. But Bontarin looked good. So credit where credit's due. Got way out grappled by Ray Borg in their fight. Had one of the craziest rounds against Kai Kara-France I've ever seen. And then he promptly got finished. So now we're where we're at now. Both guys have finishing abilities, but both guys get finished too.
Which is really interesting. So for me, this fight comes down to who can outlast the opponent. For Bontarin, it's interesting because yes, he's a good grappler, even though he's been outgrappled. Yes, he's a good wrestler, although he's been out wrestling. Yes, he's a good striker, although he's been outstruck. My problem with Bontarin, though, I don't think he has the cardio that Schnell does. With Schnell, I do think he can stay really disciplined and work behind a jab throughout a 50-minute fight because I've seen him do it before with Bontarin. It is that, like, pedal to the metal, just, kind of chaos in his fights. And yes, it worked against Kai Kara-France for the first 4 minutes and 50 seconds, but it's not that often where you can basically 10-8 a guy just to have him knock you out at the end of what was supposed to be a 10-8 round. But that's what happened against Bontorin. I just think his aggression can get him caught at some points. So at the end of the day, can Bontorin out-grapple Matt Schnell? Probably not, because Matt Schnell's never been out-grappled in the UFC. I've only ever seen his chin get checked in the UFC. I think that there's a lot to like for Matt Schnell. It's just my issue with both of these guys at the end of the day is they both kind of lack that oomph and some overall X factors to really get them up past the level that they're at in this division. Because at flyweight right now, it's either you're about to fight for a title or you're not. And right now, it feels like both these guys are outside of that conversation. So maybe if Schnell or Bontorin are able to put on a really impressive performance, they will change my mind. And maybe both guys can get matched up with one of those top five, maybe top 10 guys next. But I do like Matt Schnell in this fight. I just think his cardio is probably better than Bontorin's. If Bontorin goes and tries to be really heavy with his grappling, he might have success he did against Kai Kara France. But the issue is, Kai Kara France is a primary striker. And at the end of the day, that's what really shined through in that fight, his striking. Matt Schnell can strike very well, and I think his defensive grappling is more than enough to get this fight back up to the feet. I actually like Schnell in this fight, but this is one of those weird flyweight fights where I don't see it going to the judges' scorecards.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at it for Bontorin, he just got finished a couple of months ago. That wasn't that long ago. That was back in March. I look at it now. Schnell opened a minus 125. He's now minus 162 favorite for Bontorin. Open a plus 105. He's a plus 135. And over on Tapology, 924 total votes, 83% going with Schnell. And there are a majority for Schnell having to win by decision. It's about 80%. For Bontorin, 31% by submission, 14% by knockout. But yeah, I like Schnell in this fight again. Stick on the jab, defend a few of the early takedowns, and let's see what happens. But we're really cooking with gas in this fight.
We are. Now, I will throw this caveat in. If Bontorin catches him with a big shot early on, he can put him down. Because again, we have seen Schnell get hurt. Now, a lot of the time, he is one of those fighters who can get slightly trigger happy with his hands. If he's having a lot of success, he will bring his hands in a little bit and he can get caught with the counter. I just don't know if Bontorin is that guy to hit him with the counter. So I agree with you. I like Matt Schnell.
Love the fight. Both of us going with Louisiana's own Matt Schnell to get the win. Can't wait for the card. We got some great fights at lightweight. Ferguson, Dariush, and then you have Chandler and Oliveira for the belt, so you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Breaking news. This is an important PSA brought to you by Manscaped.com. Matt, this is your public service announcement, and you need to pay attention. You need to listen up. I'm talking to everybody at home. Listen, cats, dogs, I don't know, you could be listening to a podcast. Don't stop traffic. Chris Lang, hey, you, I know you're out there. I know you're listening. You got to tune in, Chris, because this one's for you. And this is the news that everybody has been waiting for, because the Manscaped engineering team, they've confirmed something with us. And that's that they've successfully created the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer. Holy smokes, it's now available for purchase in the USA and Canada. And Matt, the new trimmer was just released only moments ago. We are so fortunate to be one of the first. It is in the mail. It is on the way. And from personal experience, I can tell you how great these Manscaped products are. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. And listen, with this exclusive offer, it's a promo code FNP. You're going to use it at checkout. You're going to save not just like a small percentage, 20% off, and get free shipping on your order today. Now, Matt, again, I can't wait for this Lawnmower 4.0 to show up. I know it's in the mail. I know what it looks like. I'll flash a picture up there. But for everybody at home, we talked about the Lawnmower 3.0. We've had it for some time. And I can tell you one thing. I pop into my magic bag of tricks, and I've always got the Lawnmower 3.0. Now, when 4.0 comes in, I'll be as excited as a lit up tree about a month after Christmas when they're very dry and, you know, people have fires. The Christmas tree's not inside, but you have it outside and you do it safely. Just like when you're trimming your nuts with the lawnmower. Now, I've had this for a number of months, and I'm not lying when I say I haven't plugged it in once. You've seen me light this sucker up for fight companions. You've seen me here on the show. And maybe I don't trim my nuts as much as the average bear. However, I haven't had to plug it in yet. So that's pretty good that way. But with the 4.0, they have an advanced ceramic blade with skin-safe technology. It's so good that it almost seems that Manscaped worked with Elon Musk's engineers to ensure your testes are as safe as possible. Now, Matt, we've all been there. Again, I've talked about it. Shower, shaver. And the worst thing is, you're in a dark, dingy place. Let's say you went with a cheap motel. You're away from the house. These aren't COVID times. And you're shaving away. How are you going to see what you're doing? You're going to end up with a terrible mess. Probably worse than the mess that was already there because you cheaped out on a motel. But if you go with these products, they certainly do work. I can speak from experience. Matt can nod from experience.
I can.
And if you end up with the lawnmower, again, all sorts of great stuff. Multifunction on-off switch. 4000K LED spotlight when you need a precise shave. Like, there's great talking points out there, but I cannot wait for this to show up. Optimized lawnmower, 4.0 trimmer. It's really going to be great to groom in the shower. And as well, another great point, electromagnetic induction to help the battery last longer. I've already talked about how good it was in the previous iteration. I can't wait to see this. So again, get 20% off and free shipping with the promo code FNP. It's at manscaped.com. And Matt and I will, in future, tell you from experience how great it is to trim your hair with this ball hair trimmer. But again, all sorts of great products. Like, I mean, for us, we get the Shed Travel Kit that we've had for some time, the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant, the Crop Refiner or Reviver Spritz. Holy smokes, is it great. Ooh. And then the Refined Cologne, that same scent that you know and love. Matt, I'm glad that Manscaped's on board for another 3 months because straight up, I love the product. And if I didn't, we probably wouldn't talk about it. So I'm great. I'm grateful and I love it.
I didn't even know they could upgrade the 3.0. So I'm just excited that we are getting a 4.0. Because that's the thing. Like, the 3.0 actually is wicked. So the fact that we're getting a better version of that soon is just pretty exciting.
So make sure you check them out. Manscaped.com. Promo code FNP. And like all of the Fight Night Picks fans before you, and there's been a lot of you, check it out. 20% off and free shipping. Matt, can't wait for the 4.0 to show up. And as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time co-main event coming up at UFC 262. We have the former interim lightweight champ, Tony Ferguson, El Kukoi, taking on Beneil Dariush. Matt, for Beneil Dariush, what an interesting career. I mean, a lot of people might think of him as the guy that was the stepping stone to get Alexander Hernandez onto the big scene. But if you really do break it down and look at Beneil Dariush's overall body of work, it's a long career with the UFC. Outside, it was big wins, but I mean, you look at it. He beats Charlie Brennerman to come in, lose to Ramzi Nijem, and then after that, shakes off, rattles off a huge win streak. Then it got a little rocky for a bit, but since then, he's on a tidy little win streak. It's six straight, and it's the way that he's finished his opponents that really has to give those Tony Ferguson fans a little bit of pause. And Matt, if you look at it opposite Dariush, Tony Ferguson, he looks like the type of guy that watched The Matrix 3 maybe a little too many times. I mean, the guy walks around with a leather jacket, throwing a baseball around with biking gloves on. He's the most MMA-looking guy, if there was such a person. Like, when I think of, geez, who's a baseball guy? Like, you look at Mike Ford with the Yankees and you think, geez, man, that guy looks like a baseball player. Tony Ferguson, it's either I watch too many sci-fi movies or he's the best MMA fighter that people have just never heard of. Tony Ferguson, holy smokes, what a fighter. And when you put these two guys together in a cage, if you like Ferguson Pettis, if you like Ferguson, and hell, anybody he's fought, you're going to love this fight.
I mean, yeah, if you like Tony Ferguson, you're probably going to like more Tony Ferguson is what Craig's saying. Listen, this coming event is a really interesting fight. And I do think we kind of have to talk a lot about both guys' last fights if we're going to really tell the story about this fight. Because Beneil Dariush showed something. At least he showed more of a wrinkle than we always knew he had in that Diego Fajeya fight. He came out with the wrestling shoes on. And now, it wasn't like he was just going for takedown after takedown. But we always knew Dariush, he's wicked on the mat once the fight gets there. He's got good stand-up, although he can get hit sometimes. It was just how good is his wrestling? Now, when you go out there and out-wrestle a guy like Diego Fajeya, I think we learned something about your wrestling, and we at least learned something about that wrinkle in your skill set, because there's something we talk about a lot on this channel, where it doesn't always matter how you beat a guy, it doesn't matter who you beat, it's how you beat them. And yes, Gregor Gillespie might have been able to finish Diego Fajeya, who showed up maybe out of weight and maybe out of shape, who knows, but yes, he was able to beat him and finish him, but if you look at how Dariush beat Fajeya, I would argue it was just as impressive. He went scramble for scramble with him. He out-grappled him on the mat, and it wasn't even really close. Now, yes, Diego Fajeya had a few scrambles, but Beneil Dariush, he's one of those great combinations of it's not just submission and it's not just position. He can kind of float between those two zones, and that's what makes Dariush such a dangerous fighter. And for Ferguson, you look at how many takedowns he gave up against Charles Oliveira, and going into that fight, yes, I thought Oliveira was going to win, but I didn't think Oliveira was going to win by consistently out-wrestling Tony Ferguson from the opening bell until the last minute of that fight. But that's what we saw in that last fight. So personally, I'll be really interested to see what version of Beneil Dariush do we get in this fight. If he comes out striking like he did against Jakar Close, at least in the second round of that fight, then maybe he could get caught by Tony Ferguson. Because Tony Ferguson's a lot of things. Is he crazy? Maybe, but it's worked out for him so far. Like, Like, all those weird training regimens that people like to make fun of, you don't become Tony Ferguson if all that stuff doesn't somehow help you in your MMA training. Like, everyone would be training like Tony Ferguson, I'm sure, if they could, but all that weirdness and all that kind of uniqueness about Tony Ferguson, I do think helps him. If you're the only person training like that, then there's just gonna be some things that you can do that other people can't. Look at GSP. People thought he was crazy when he started doing gymnastics. They were like, hey, gymnastics, like, that's not gonna help you in MMA. And then GSP, he thought about it kind of like an advanced statistician would. He's like, no, you can't just take it at face value. I do gymnastics not because I'm trying to become a better gymnast, because I want to work on my core strength. I want to work on my balance. He realized there was other things that he could take from that one kind of training. I'm not saying Tony Ferguson's some training genius like GSP was. I just don't think he gets the credit he deserves when it does come to some of these bizarre training methods.
Well, and the weirdest thing about this fight, so for Benil Dariush, she's been a longtime Kings MMA guy, and you look at the way that Kings has kind of evolved. Are there good fighters at jiu-jitsu? 100% there are. Are there good wrestlers there? Yes. Are there good strikers? For sure. The three marquee fighters right now out of Kings, other than maybe Mike Tyson, but Marvin Vettori, huge fight coming up in the rematch with Adesanya for the belt. Giga Chikadze, Benil Dariush. I would say those are three of the bigger fighters. What are they good at? Well,
everything.
Giga, the last time that he lost, tried to grapple with Austin Springer. It was a little silly, but yeah, they're good at pretty much everything. And if they're good in one specific discipline, they tend to kind of round it out. We've seen that from Benil Dariush. Now, with the Fajeo fights, the first fight kind of did the same thing. He out-wrestled him. He was positionally aware. He was able to keep top position. Against a guy like Tony Ferguson, other than Charles Oliveira, we've never seen Tony Ferguson positionally dominated like that before. And before that, his last loss, Michael Johnson. I mean, boxing back and forth. Michael Johnson's a hard guy to beat.
Well, okay, he was a hard guy to beat.
Yeah, before, like, 2018. He was a really hard guy to beat. He had a really close fight with Artem Lobov, and I saw that fight with my own two eyes and breathed the same air. But when I look at a fight like this, the weird thing for me with Tony Ferguson, it's not so much the unorthodox training. We make fun of it, but seriously, it works for the guy, yeah. And if it works for you, why would you abandon it? Well, that's where I'm going with this. He still trains at Snap City or Snapdown City, but he also trains at Wildcard Boxing, and again, GSP, we've seen do that. We've seen other fighters kind of mix it up with boxing coaches. And at Wildcard,
TJ Dillashaw did it.
It's Freddie Roach, and that's who you're training with. Now, we've seen that work for a lot of fighters, but normally it's mid-career, beginning of the career, not at the end of his career. And then the other thing I just want to add, Freddie Roach kind of got it in Aaron Pico's head that he was the best boxer ever.
Frank, stop.
You look at it.
I know, but this is one point that we're going to disagree on camera, and that's fine. I don't think you can just look at Aaron Pico and say, hey, he got knocked out early in a fight, and it's because everyone was telling him the whole time he was a boxer. Aaron Pico always fights like that, no matter who he's fighting. He's always going to come out with that striking first approach. I don't think you can blame Freddie Roach for his MMA, I guess, non-success that he's had. Now, luckily, Aaron Pico has been able to turn it around, but I think the reason Ferguson wanted to go train with Roach was because look at his fight against Gaethje. What was the one area that Tony Ferguson really lacked in that fight? It was boxing defense, and one thing that Freddie Roach will be able to teach you, I don't care how old you are, I don't care what gym you are or what background you've had, he's going to teach you how to become a more fundamentally sound boxer. Now, there is a question to see. Well, no, he is. It's not even that. Freddie Roach, one of the best boxers. He coached Manny Pacquiao, Craig. Manny Pacquiao is one of the greatest boxers ever. My whole point is that I think Tony Ferguson went there to help up some of his holes with his striking defense. But again, that's what this fight comes back to. Tony Ferguson made a career of being able to take damage, and he could take damage. It was always kind of comical to a certain degree. Ferguson would be able to eat shots that would put 98% of fighters out on the roster, and he could walk through it. But I'm at this stage, and I guess I'll toss it off to you, because we kind of saw Cowboy. He got finished, and we've seen him get finished before, but he got finished by strikes that you never thought would have put him out earlier on in his career. If you think Dariush starts landing early, do you think he can have success on the feet like Gaethje was able to, or do you think Ferguson is still that step ahead of Dariush on the feet?
That's it. I mean, you look at the losses, you look at the wins. So let's focus on it for Ferguson, the five on in, so to speak. Kevin Lee, and he submits him. That was a great win. That was almost 4 years ago. Like, it's crazy to think about that. Anthony Pettis, back and forth fight. Pettis gets hurt. Coach calls it off in the middle, or in the corner between rounds. Donald Cerrone finishes him. Again, Donald blew it out, probably shouldn't have, but he beat him in that fight. Then you lose to Gaethje, where he took crazy amounts of damage. Like, that was a career worth of damage in one single fight. It was gross to see. And then he fights Charles Oliveira, and again, takes all the damage in the fight against Gaethje. And the fight against Charles Oliveira, it's a hit to the ego more than anything. I mean, the weird ego thing, too, that plays into this is if you go out and you watch the UFC countdown, Tony Ferguson's first thing that they bring him up saying is, Well, I only trained 5 hours of jiu-jitsu for that fight. Why? Why?
It is kind of weird.
It's so weird.
Because, like, okay, one of the... And I know we're going to talk about this later, but, like, Charles Oliveira became a third-degree black belt right before his fight with Michael Chandler. If you're Michael Chandler and you read that headline, you're probably a little nervous. Tony Ferguson knew he was getting ready for a fight against, at the time, a second-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. The fact that he is a second-degree black belt already is ridiculous. We normally talk about fighters, they have one black belt, and we get impressed by that. He was fighting a guy who is just one of the best grapplers ever in MMA, and like you had said, he barely trained his grappling. So I do wonder, what kind of Tony Ferguson are we going to get? Is he going to come out looking to strike? Does he believe his jiu-jitsu is better than the jiu-jitsu of Benil Dariush? Because that's honestly a question that I would love to see get answered. Because with Dariush, I know how good he is on the mat. He does take a lot of risks, but once he gets to the back, he can really just finish you no matter where he goes. With Ferguson, he's unorthodox on the feet, but he's also really unorthodox with his grappling. So again, there's just so many question marks every time I break down a Tony Ferguson fight. Here's the few guarantees I can tell you in a 3-round fight, though. Tony Ferguson's never getting tired in a 3-round fight ever. He doesn't get tired in 5-round fights that he's losing 24 minutes in. So I really doubt cardio is going to be an issue really for either guy in this fight. But for me, this fight comes down to durability, which is weird because I feel like the story's been kind of switched on both of these fighters. Benil Dariush was kind of like Dustin Poirier, where there was this narrative out there that he's kind of chinny. Like, yes, his skills are really good, but if you can crack him, he goes down. In this kind of last few fights or this run that Dariush has been on, you can hit him and he does still stand from it. So you've got all the great well-roundedness of Benil Dariush. He's got power in his hands now, and now he seems to have a pretty good chin. This is a hard fighter for Tony Ferguson to beat.
Yeah, I mean, you really look at it, and with Benil Dariush, we've seen him crack since UFC 222 when he fought Hernandez. I mean, geez, Shakur Close was able to start to kind of land. Scott Holtzman was able to do a little bit. Diego Faye didn't, but he's had some really competitive fights. And then again, you look at it for Ferguson, he had the crazy win streak, he was the uncrowned champ, we had so many different fights with Habib that all fell through. And now we're at a point where Tony Ferguson opened as the favorite for this fight. He opened up a minus 125 or thereabouts on best fight odds. That line dropped off the bat. He's a plus 134 underdog right now. When can you think of the last time that Tony Ferguson, when a line would go that squirrely? And for Benil Dariush, obviously, would have opened the underdog at about a plus 105. He's a minus 163 favorite right now. If we look over on best fight odds, it's close. 1,156 total votes, 54% Dariush, 75% have him to win by decision. For the 46% that have Ferguson to win, 10% by submission, 33% by knockout, the remaining percentage by decision. Seems like people are thinking there's more of an avenue to victory for Ferguson to win by finish. I would argue for Dariush, you have to think that way just based on the fact that, again, he took on such a credential grappler in Diego Faye. Now, I get it. There's a lot of people out there, and I want to hear from you in the comments section on this fight. This one's going to dominate fight week. There's a lot of people that are going to go, Mr. Bellator is going to lose. Mr. UFC featherweight's going to win up at lightweight. Oliveira, we're talking Oliveira Chandler. But when we talk about this fight right here between Ferguson and Dariush, again, Dariush has had those finish losses. He's had to kind of come back. And he's still a young guy at 32. I mean, really in his physical prime. For Tony Ferguson, if we're talking physical primes being 32, you're outside of that window, but he's still putting on such impressive performances. Now we've seen him eat a lot of damage where normally he's the better striker. He got totally and absolutely positionally dominated in his last fight. I mean, the avenues are there for Dariush.
But they obviously... Okay, we're not giving Tony Ferguson any credit right now, and this needs to stop. Tony Ferguson's probably going to knock out Benil Dariush. Here's this little X factor I've been holding on to till the end of this video. Benil Dariush on the inside isn't a great fighter. On the outside, he's got good kicks to the body, and he has good straight punches. But my problem with Dariush is, if you go back and look at when Canelo fought Billy Joe Saunders, after Canelo hurt Saunders, what can you do when you're a hurt fighter? You can either make so much space between you and your opponent that they can't reach you to damage you, or you collapse as much space as possible, and then they have no room to actually get off their power shots. The problem with Dariush is he has power shots at a distance, but up close, he does kind of struggle. And with Tony Ferguson, one thing Tony Ferguson is always going to be better than most guys in the cage with is his elbows. And the one thing that people have just completely forgotten about, go back and watch that Josh Thompson fight. You bring up the fact that Benil Dariush is able to out-grapple Diego Faja. That's cute. Tony Ferguson out-grappled RDA and Kevin Lee. Two fighters who I hold in much higher regard than Diego Fajeyas. So, although, yes, Dariush has had a lot of impressive performances as of late, beating Diego Fajeyas, I don't think, means as much as beating Kevin Lee, especially for the title in a five-round atmosphere. Yes, he lost to Justin Gaethje, but Justin Gaethje's beaten a lot of guys. And Justin Gaethje, if you can't take him down, it's just a tough night in the office for pretty much everyone in the UFC. So, I think a lot of people are overlooking Tony Ferguson. And my weird prediction, if you want a really, really honest one, I think Tony Ferguson might win this fight by TKO. My prediction, just because I want to beat Craig by the end of the year, is going to be Benil Dariush. I think the overall wrestling of Dariush is going to be too much for Tony Ferguson, to where if it does get on the inside, I do think Dariush will be able to out-wrestle him. But the big key for this fight is, people have to realize that Tony Ferguson, he doesn't get the respect he deserves on the feet because of what happened in that Gaethje fight. Gaethje might be able to box you up on the outside. It doesn't mean Dariush is going to be able to. Like, I honestly think Ferguson should probably be minus in this fight, but I do think Dariush's wrestling is going to be the overpowered thing. I think a lot of people are coming into this fight expecting Dariush to look like Justin Gaethje did, or at least fight in a similar manner, defend the takedowns, try to expose some of the flaws in the feet, but I think Dariush is going to fight Ferguson exactly like Charles Oliveira did. People used to love to bring up the fact that Tony Ferguson, he was a high school wrestler, Division I, all this. Tony Ferguson doesn't wrestle in MMA, and that's the real big issue. If you don't do it in MMA, and if you don't ever refine or sharpen that sword or that weapon that you have, you're not going to get better at it. I think Benil Dariush is going to outclass Ferguson on the mat if we see any version of this fight.
So Matt just gave you an avenue to victory for Tony Ferguson, said that he was going to pick Tony Ferguson, changed his pick to Benil Dariush, now it's back to me. So it's almost like going on a beach roller coaster and thinking, man, it's great to see that this has been up since 1880, but one of these days it's going to rot right down to the ground and somebody's going to fall through it, and that's what just happened. So when I'm looking at this fight, let's give flowers to Tony Ferguson and then finally give off that final pick, talk about where we're going. Again, you look at it, all the finish wins for Ferguson, the only guys that he wasn't able to finish, RDA, but you brought it up. In 2016... RDA wasn't all that far removed from being a champion.
At elevation, too, and Tony Ferguson beat the brakes off him throughout five rounds.
Impressive, impressive win. The Lando Venata fight, if you want to see a fight where it's back and forth, and of course, Lando Venata on this card, that fight's it. I mean, Tony Ferguson, I'm just going to roll through the punches. I'm going to do Granby rolls when there's nobody on me. I'm just going to move.
It works.
Like water. And then you just look at the overall body again. The Gleison Tibau win, Josh Thompson, Edson Barboza. Did Gleison Tibau give Khabib Nurmagomedov fits?
I'm sure.
But not Tony Ferguson. So Tony Ferguson's taken this full amount of damage over his entire career. Then you look at these last two fights, and it's just tricky because Ferguson normally wins on the feet. Ferguson can beat anybody on the mat. Yes, those are two of the highest level examples. Former interim champ as well in Gaethje, and then a title challenger in this card, on this card, in the main event. But Benil Dariush, to a lesser extent, can do a lot of those things very well. He can shoot from range. He can hit from range. He has that whip at the end of his shots that we love to see. For me, I like Benil Dariush, but if there's ever been a pop and popcorn fight, this is it.
This is going to win fight of the night. Like, at the end of the night, Dana White's just probably going to get up there and be like, listen, guys, y'all know who fight of the night is going to go to. This is the fight I'm the most excited for. This is the whole point I was trying to make. Don't just think that when it's on the feet, Ferguson's going to be losing, and when it's on the mat, Ferguson's going to be winning. I think there's going to be areas where both guys have success on the feet and on the mat. I wouldn't even be surprised if Ferguson has good areas on the mat, but at the end of the day, I just think the wrestling of Benil Dariush is the thing that's going to win out. I do think it was a little bit ridiculous in hindsight that people thought Ferguson was kind of the foil to Khabib, because I just think stylistically Khabib would be a very bad matchup for him. But at the end of the day, I think Dariush is probably going to pick up the biggest win of his UFC career.
Both of us going with Benil Dariush to get the win. I can't wait for the fight. Pop and popcorn all around. Make sure you join in with a fight companion. Oh, yeah. I'm sure one of us is going to go absolutely insane. If not both of us, Matt, absolutely loving this fight, loving this card. You're not going to want to miss our video for the Chandler-Oliveira fight at the top. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
For the first time in years, your lightweight title is on the line in a fight that doesn't include Khabib Nurmagomedov. We have the former Bellator king, three times over, Michael Chandler. Iron Mike taking on Dobronx, Charles Oliveira. And Matt, I couldn't be more excited for a fight. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. On my left, your right, at MattAllenFNP on the respective socials. Matt, we've talked about Michael Chandler for what seems like the longest time. If you're new to Fight Night Picks, again, we appreciate you, the likes, the subs, and so on and so forth. But we host a little show, and we're going to have it this week on Wednesday, called This Week in MMA. We focus on PFL, ONE Championship, Bellator, the other organizations that aren't the UFC. And if Michael Chandler wasn't on your radar before 2020, well, holy smokes, is he ever now? Because this is a guy that weighed in as the alternate for your fight, UFC 254. You had Gaethje taking on Khabib. Unfortunate for him that neither one of those guys fell out. But he did get a great booking against Dan Hooker that certainly worked out in his favor, earning him this ticket. And for Charles Oliveira, one of the craziest win streaks we've seen in a long time. 8 fights in a row before his last fight against Tony Ferguson, a lopsided decision. 7 finishes in a row. And Matt, I got to read these out before I hand it over. Tied for first and most finishes in the UFC with Cowboy Cerrone at 16. Number 1 overall in submission wins in the UFC at 14. Number 2 at Fight of the Night bonuses at 16 behind Cowboy Cerrone's 18. And he's also number 2 at submission attempts at 35 behind Jim Miller's 45. Matt, what hasn't Charles Oliveira done but capture a title at this point?
And I mean, really, that's the only thing he has left to do. Unless he, like, rejoins the Ultimate Fighter, I guess. If that's something he really wants to get on the mantelpiece. But for Charles Oliveira, it's just been a wild ride to get to this title shot. Because he's been in the UFC for a lot longer than I think people realize. Like, he's been in the UFC for almost a decade now. And the fact that he has been able to stay around for this long, fighting the absolute best of the best, is really impressive. And I don't think anybody expected Charles Oliveira would finally beat Royce Gracie's record for most submissions in the UFC. But that's who it is. Charles Oliveira. Is it safe to say he's the most dangerous grappler in UFC history? It might be true, because Charles Oliveira is really interesting. He's one of the few fighters where he's not just in a set position when they're on the mat. He's everywhere at once, and I wish I had a better way to describe it. He just has this really unique way of floating on top of his opponent, or even underneath his opponent when he is on the mat. He's so dangerous on top or on bottom that really any second you're on the mat with him is kind of the equivalent of trading punches with Francis on the feet.
Let's go into it. You look at the 2014 submission of the year, you talk about it, in a fight against Hatsu Hioki, where there's one of the most disgusting eye pokes you're ever going to see, to the point where Hioki takes Oliveira down, who's on his back, and he starts kind of pawing at his eye because it hurts, but I'm not in trouble because I'm Charles Oliveira. And then the action kind of moves around a little bit, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, Charles is going for a guillotine. Oh, this isn't a guillotine, it's a Peruvian necktie. Oh, submission of the year 2014. Like, he can get out-wrestled and then submit the wrestler like that. It's crazy.
He's a third-degree black belt jiu-jitsu. He doesn't have to be good at wrestling. That's really the point with Charles Oliveira. He's going to get out-wrestled in this fight. Michael Chandler is a far superior wrestler, but why would you ever take Charles Oliveira to the mat? That's really my whole point. If you're taking him to the mat, you're just helping him do half his job for him. Yes, he was able to out-wrestle Tony Ferguson, but he's not going to be able to go out there and do the same thing to a guy like Michael Chandler. Michael Chandler's going to be able to judge where this fight takes place, and that's a really interesting thing that Michael Chandler has the power over, because if he feels like he's having success on the feet, he can dictate whether this fight goes to the mat or not. Whereas Oliveira, if he's having success on the feet and gets taken down, he's got to do everything he can to get the fight back up to his, or back up to the feet. And it's just a lot of energy wasted for Oliveira. So for me, this fight has a lot of different wrinkles to talk about. But the first one that's most important, I think, is cardio. Because I think these are two guys who have exceptional cardio. But it will be really interesting, because both guys have a really high work rate too. And I do think both guys are going to kind of have to use their volume against the other. If you're Chandler, I don't think takedowns are going to be the key to this fight. I think the overwhelming amount of takedowns will be the key to this fight. Taking down Charles Oliveira once is kind of a death sentence, but if you can take him down and be positionally aware enough to not get submitted, do it rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. Make him work a lot that you can wear down on him as the fight progresses. Paul Felder knocked this guy out on the ground. That's kind of the whole point. Like, Charles Oliveira on the ground, he's so dangerous with his submissions that he can somewhat kind of be lackadaisical and he'll just kind of lay there. And if you do have really good ground and pound like Michael Chandler has, you can really make him pay for it. So I do feel like Oliveira's grappling is kind of a double-edged sword. But on the flip side of that, Michael Chandler is a very powerful striker, but he isn't the most durable guy in the world when it comes to his overall durability with his chin. So it will be a little curious to see if Chandler's the one having success on the feet, and then he gets hurt, will he even want to take this fight to the mat afterwards, or will he just kind of risk it on the feet?
Well, if you look at Michael Chandler, and I know there's going to be a lot of people out there, you're going to fill the comment section, you're going to say, oh, Patricio Pitbull knocked out Michael Chandler. Patricio Pitbull's a hell of a fighter. He's one of those guys that's on that list of, he's outside of the UFC, it's a shame that he's, how old he is now, that he didn't make it to the UFC. He wants fights with Volkanovski, he wants fights with the top guys, and I'd love to see them. They won't happen. But for Michael Chandler, listen, he had those contractual issues. Was he going to end up with the UFC? A few years ago, it didn't happen. He re-signed with Bellator. And then you look at the fighters that he's taken on. Is Sydney Outlaw all that good at 160 pounds when they fought at catchweight over in Japan? No. But Michael Chandler beat him the way you wanted to see him win. When he fought Benson Henderson, was Bendo over the hill? Yeah, maybe he was, but still, great win for Michael Chandler. Comes into the UFC, finishes the UFC guy, and now it's like, oh, he's gained our respect. We see how good Michael Chandler is. And this is a guy that they show it in the countdowns and the embeds. Does he drive from Tennessee to Florida sometimes to go to Sanford? Yeah. But look at the people he's training with at Sanford MMA. Look at the quality of partners. Look at the Jason Jackson up at 170. Look at Gilbert Burns at 155. We can go down through the list, but there's so many great fighters there at the gym. And you're also going to work on your strength and conditioning and so on and so forth. For Michael Chandler, the only thing that I worry about, out of all of the fights, out of all of the Bellator fights, and you can pick on them, you can nitpick, you can say, well, Brent Primus back at Bellator NYC, why did he lose? Listen, it was the old nerve situation.
It was weird.
It was weird. It was really weird. But then he beats Gotye Yamauchi, who's a hell of a fighter. Then he beats Brandon Gertz, where he just picks him up, throws him down, pops his shoulder at a socket, and finishes Brandon Gertz. Then he beats Brent Primus in 2018. In Hawaii, great fight, really neat. There's one point, though, in the early rounds where Brent Primus gets Michael Chandler's back, and you go, oh, holy smokes, this isn't good. And then from then on out, Michael Chandler dominates the rest of the fight. Brent Primus, again, has a win over Chandler. He is the former champ. But the point is, Brent Primus is a really good fighter on the ground. He's a very good wrestler. He's very credentialed. He's just not at the same level as Charles Oliveira.
I'm going to push back on that argument. I'm sorry. The problem is, that was one moment in that fight. Do you want to know what happened for the other 25 minutes? Michael Chandler beat Brent Primus, and it wasn't competitive at all on the mat. It is, again, this fight really does come down to the wrestling of Michael Chandler. And I'm going to say this. We both had him to beat Dan Hooker. A lot of people didn't agree with us on that. I have the same opinion of Michael Chandler right now as I did before that fight. They didn't teach me anything I didn't already know. What did Michael Chandler do in that? Well, he pressured, kept his head low, and threw wild overhands until one landed. Isn't that what he's done his whole career, unless he gets the takedown? Now, yes, he did. He lands that great overhand left, hits him with all those, like, hammer fists there, Brock Lesnar style, and it was a great performance, but again, him beating Dan Hooker in that way didn't prove to me a single thing I didn't know. The other thing about that fight, too, Michael Chandler still is susceptible to leg kicks. He's not a fighter who, he was a victim of that calf kick, and then he turned that into a weapon that then he later used on his opponents. People hate it when I talk about Dustin Poirier, but it's the truth. Like, Jim Miller did it to him, Justin Gaethje did it to him, and then you watch Justin Poirier kicks Max Holloway's legs, kicks Conor McGregor's legs. He's a fighter who, when you use something against him, and if it works, he'll use that in his own arsenal. With Chandler, even in the short opening of the Dan Hooker fight, he still does need a few leg kicks in that, and that's just one of those weaknesses that is always going to worry me about Chandler, because he's a guy who does plant and throw a lot, and if you can take away his base, you really get rid of a lot of the power that he brings into the fight. But with that being said, the amount of power he does bring into the fight is kind of ridiculous. At 155, I would argue, it's probably him and Justin Gaethje who have the hardest just pound-for-pound punch in this division. I would argue Chandler has that kind of punching power. Again, though, my issues with Chandler is he's going to need the takedown to make this fight competitive, and I don't think Charles Oliveira is the kind of guy you want to take down just ever. Kevin Lee had a few moments where, yes, he was able to stay on top of Oliveira and not get submitted, at least earlier on in that fight, but then once Oliveira really starts to open up with his strikes, he forces a bad takedown attempt out of Kevin Lee and immediately submits him. Charles Oliveira really does have that one-punch, one-kill type of power, but it is jiu-jitsu on the mat, so for Oliveira, I think his striking's taken a massive leap throughout this last little run at 155. I think he was one of the weirdest fighters ever who he'd win at 155 and then immediately we'd get on the mic and be like, hey, featherweight, I'm coming back. I know I missed weight a few times and I'm great at 155, but like, I still don't think I'm done down there. That was just really weird. I'm really glad that we've kind of passed that stage of Charles Oliveira's career. But for Oliveira, I just think this is a dangerous fight for Chandler. On the feet, Oliveira has enough power to, I think it can hurt Chandler. I don't think Oliveira can knock out Chandler. I don't. I do think Chandler's a good enough striker to where he can at least stay defensively sound to where he's not going to get put out by a strike, but I do think Oliveira can hurt Chandler on the feet. We even saw, go back to the Gotye Yamauchi fight, Gotye Yamauchi is a ridiculous grappler. Now, he's not on the Charles Oliveira level because, let's be honest, I don't really think anyone's on that Charles Oliveira level, but for a Bellator Charles Oliveira, that's a pretty good kind of comparison. Gotye Yamauchi rocks Michael Chandler in that fight, but after he rocks him with like a weird crane kick, he wasn't able to capitalize on it because his striking isn't at that next level. If Oliveira hurts you on the feet, he's just going to throw a ton of volume afterwards, force you to make a bad takedown attempt, and then he almost automatically has your back from that. I just think Charles Oliveira at this point in his career has really found a way to mesh his striking along with his jiu-jitsu in a way that I think is going to be really tough for any fighter who relies on a takedown in their MMA game, and that's why I like Oliveira against Chandler.
It's a really, really interesting fight. Again, you get the power punching, you get the wrestling out of Chandler. He's a classic. If he trained at any gym and if you pegged him for any gym, probably Extreme Couture. He's Team just Alpha one Male. Of those guys, or even Team Alpha Male. But you look at it for both of these guys. Chandler was overdoing it with Bellator, and then for Oliveira, 10 performance of the night bonuses, 3 submission of the night bonuses, 3 fight of the nights, 2 of them against Nick Lentz, 1 of them against Frankie Edgar. And it's just insane how his career's progressed, but that's it. It's the meshing of the striking with the jiu-jitsu for him. For Michael Chandler, wars with Eddie Alvarez, he won one, he lost one. And then after he lost Eddie Alvarez, he lost twice to Ill Will Brooks, who didn't have a great run in the UFC, but was a boogeyman over with Bellator for a while. And it's just interesting to see where his career's gone as well, because this is a guy that went from Strikeforce to Bellator. He fought Creed Zone. Can you take me higher? Scott Stapp, but not actually that Scott Stapp, but he did beat Scott Stapp with Bellator. And the losses are kind of wonky. The wins, holy smokes. But this is a guy, Division I All-American at University of Missouri, developed a bit of a kinship with Ben Askren and Tyron Woodley, names that you don't really love to hear around MMA these days. But with wrestling, it's great. And it's just interesting to see. Is he going to try and chain wrestle? Because that's something he used to be able to do. Will we see it? Will we see the power punching? Will we see the ground and pound? Michael Chandler, you know what you're going to get. DeBronx, you know what you're going to get. So everybody out there should have a decent idea of what we should get should one of these guys win, unless hell freezes over and we get something totally different. But the odds on this one, Charles Oliveira, open minus 178. He's minus 133 at this point. Michael Chandler, open a plus 146. He's plus 109 or thereabouts. We haven't looked at the Tapology votes. They're always fun. Holy smokes, 1,155 of them. 51% Oliveira, with 73% taking him to win by submission. For the 49% that have Chandler, 88% by knockout. It's really close.
It really is. And I was going to say, even before we went to the Tapology votes, I don't think I can remember the last time there's been a main event that's been this kind of closely contested up until, like, Again, I feel like we've laid out good ways for both guys to win, but that's what I mean. Both guys have so many ways that they can win this fight. Michael Chandler and Charles Oliveira represent just really the peak of MMA. Like, they are specialists, but they're also really good in every other aspect of MMA, and that's what makes really the lightweight division, the welterweight division, the featherweight division, kind of those glamour divisions, so much fun. I couldn't tell you the last time I was this excited for a matchup, just skill set wise. Take the fighters' personalities out of it, take all the build up and whatnot. Just the skills of Charles Oliveira versus the skills of Michael Chandler is something that I think we can all get really excited about. But my last prediction, finally, I gotta say Charles Oliveira. At the end of the day, I just think if he hurts Chandler on the feet, I think that's going to open up a big enough window for Oliveira to win by submission. Now, I understand that might not make a lot of sense, but in a guy like Oliveira, he's really refined his striking to the point where Oliveira can go out there and outstrike a lot of guys at 155. He does have that really high, upright style, very Muay Thai-esque. And here's the other thing. If Michael Chandler had Vicente Luque in his camp, and if Vicente Luque was an active member of his camp throughout this fight camp, I'd like Michael Chandler a lot more. Because what does Vicente Luque do? He strikes almost exactly like Charles Oliveira. Now, yes, he doesn't throw those, like, jumping switch kicks and whatnot, but they both have very high Thai styles. And yes, Luque probably hits harder, and I'd say Oliveira might be a little bit faster. But style, realistically, I just think that would have been a great guy for Chandler to have in his camp for this fight. So finally, I like Charles Oliveira.
We'll have to see how the gas tanks react in this fight too. So it'll be interesting to see, can Chandler last against a guy like Oliveira? Can Oliveira last against a guy like Chandler? Whose pressure is going to win out? And in a fight like this, it really, really is tricky. Shoot the Box versus Sanford MMA at the highest level. And Michael Chandler's never been submitted either, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. While for DeBronx, if you go through it, his last loss, and now we're going back 8 fights, the Felder TKO loss. He lost to Lamas by submission. He lost to Pettis by submission. He lost to Max Holloway. Again,
that's a weird fight.
Big names, too. So,
and at 145. That's the big thing about Charles Oliveira. Yes, the Paul Felder loss is at 155, but we talked about Kama Worthy like this a lot before he started getting knocked down at 145, but you know where I'm going 55. With it. Or at 155, but you know where I'm going with this. Like, fighters can be fighting in the wrong weight class, and if you're Charles Oliveira, you're just so good that even though you are in the wrong weight class, you're still able to work your way up the ranks. I just think we're seeing, instead of Charles Oliveira, who is at like an 80% of himself at 145 because he was cutting so much weight, we're really able to see Charles Oliveira, who, let's say throughout 8 weeks of camp, he doesn't have to dedicate 4 weeks to getting his weight down and then 4 weeks to test his skills. He can now just dedicate all 8 weeks to getting better as a fighter, and I really think that's what he's done this last streak.
Matt, absolutely love the fight. I'm in agreement with you. I'm going with Charles Oliveira. I think, again, the pressure of the striking, the jiu-jitsu, and Michael Chandler, if he takes him down, maybe he will be able to be positionally aware enough. But I've seen wrestlers take on Charles Oliveira and get submitted quite easily. So it'll be interesting to see. I like Oliveira ever so slightly, but Matt, I absolutely love this fight. it is the definition of pop and popcorn being so close. We're going to be tuning in live with the Fight Companion, so you're going to have to tune in with us because those reactions tend to get pretty crazy. I mean, if I didn't queue up the one earlier for Chandler, I'll throw it in here at some point.
Michael Chandler with a beautiful shot. Dan Hooker is down and he is hurt.
Oh! Okay. Chandler's got a rock. Chandler might TKO! Wow! What a debut by Michael Chandler! UFC lightweight! Holy smokes! But wow, absolutely great card. Love all of these fights. Your co-main event, Dariush taking on Ferguson. There's so many.
So
Grundy's taking on Vanata. That one might fly under the radar. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We're going to have a great week during this fight week. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it.